Okay, Mini Max, are you still on the chat line? Let's see if he answers. Mini Max, are you there? He just types something in. Well, he probably can't hear it. Well, no, he can hear us if he's on. Okay, let me just do something here. Okay, just a second. Okay, I'm going to unmute everybody. No, I'm not muted, Carol.
Hello.
Yeah, you're not on. Okay, I'm unmute everybody. And
all participants are now unmuted.
The smarter people here would be interested, or the more ascended people. We've got Brian here, Mini Max, Mick Max, and all these different things he calls himself. Now, I'm offering him here to be interviewed by you people. To find out what is Brian on about on the chat line, or what does he think of all this stuff where he's not intimidated by Ion. I'm sure we have all kinds of interesting answers. So I'll start with Bert. What's something you've always wanted to ask Brian or Minimax, Bert?
Yeah, it's funny because I haven't got to the point of re-listening to when he came on. But Brian, what is your... It seems that you're listening to the show and it sparks your unique responses to chat on the chat. What's the driver behind it? Can you describe that?
Well, I mean, I can't help but monitor what Bob does. That's for sure. I mean, it's been we're coming up on 20 years now since I first encountered Bob, and he kind of like. I don't know, hit my funny bone or something and created a sort of a permanent fixation or imprinting of like, wow, this guy is playing that note that tunes the world, or he's playing that note that creates a harmonic that makes this crazy world not make sense, but it creates a bizarre heat inversion of some kind, like whatever the effect of what he was doing. I'm helpless to, I can't not keep track of it. So even if I'm not really in the mood to pay a lot of attention, I usually throw the shows on if I can. And then if I think of some funny, what would be the word? Like a peanut gallery kind of a comment, just a wise crack on the sidelines, then I'll type it onto the chat as just similarly trying to come up with micro modules of a similar sort of a counterpoint. Or, you know, I try to be a little bit finicky sometimes, and then sometimes I get on, I get ranty about expressing something. But the important point, which I think was well demonstrated late Saturday night or early Sunday morning, is that me calling in or being called, me being on the show, it doesn't necessarily work for anybody, me or the show, unless you find it really entertaining, the bickering between Ion and Bob about why I'm being given time. Like, I don't like hearing that. To me, it's just like, it's just, you know, Ion breaking character and being really cringe or something. And I don't want to be responsible for provoking that. So I would usually prefer to just sit on the sidelines and kibitz.
Right. Let me say something, Bert. When you asked your question, I was going to say it's all about me. And then he said it. And it's exactly right. He actually described that very well. It's, I would have said something like, well, it's about me in a sense. He's going to go where I go. He's studying me as he knew me, or as the world knew me. And then he's watching what unfolds. And that's why a lot of his remarks are just for me. He's commenting to me in our ongoing dialogue through the years what he thinks is going on or how he's interpreting what Ion or somebody says. So it's definitely a dialogue. And that's why I thought Brian should come on, and I wanted to see if he would say that. And he has. So that should clarify, Bert, what Brian is doing, why he's sort of on the sidelines. He's my Boswell. Remember how Boswell followed Dr. Johnson around all over the place? Wrote a book on him or something?
Yeah.
That's what Brian's doing. Now, Brian is smart enough to notice that there is something going on. He picked that up on, I guess, November 24th, 2003, when I spoke at the Coach House. And then after that, we went to Sleeper's place, he and Nigel and a bunch of us. We had an interesting evening. That was the beginning. But then I always remember, oh, no, it happened the year before when he brought Sam to New York, or he went with Sam to stay at Sam's relative's apartment. And that was a month after I left Nelson Thal's show. So that's November, December 2002. And they interviewed me. It was a very good, long interview. And it got all transcribed. Then part of it got lost. So there's only half of it or a third of it available. But he's been tracking me ever since, Bert. Now, did you know that, Bert? You knew this.
Yes.
Probably.
Yes, I remember. Yes, I remember when he first came on. And he's the one person that stayed on from the Subgeniuses. I remember that. He infiltrated. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And he's the only one complimented by staying.
And the one recruit. Yeah. The one successful conversion, eh?
No. Well, I'm saying this. That Stang said, you are the best writer of, and it was Chad and a bunch of other people on there trying to write or say stuff, and it didn't meet their vicious standards. But Brian, I don't know, had a lot of psychobabble or something ridiculous in there, and Stang said, you're a good writer, but you're too much of a deanie for me to allow you in, so I'm not going to take your membership offering. That happened way back then, 2004 or so, right, Brian?
Yeah, although, I that's probably a generous rephrasing of what he said. It was a little more sarcastic than that and cutting or whatever, but, you know, that's...
But he recognized
that's
Brian
basically
was
being expressed.
Yeah, it's like Brian, Stang had artistic standards, sort of, and Brian met those as a writer, and they probably never understood half of what Brian was saying, but that was good. That's Subgenius. But because he had the stain of being in Canada and saying knew he was associated with me, he wasn't going to let a smart person in there spying too closely. Then I would say that Brian has learned a lot hanging out with me. He's met all kinds of groups of people by just tracking me. And they usually went back to his high school interests in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was to his advantage to keep tracking me.
And I've had a weird, I've had just a strange or, I don't know, I'm not going to waste time looking for the adjective. I've had an odd angle on the Ion thing right from the beginning, because when Ion emerged, I was like at the peak point of being enmeshed in this like synchronicity obsession that was opening up as a vast subplot to the, because I see the Bob versus Bob drama that I imprinted back in those days of, you know, this Bob versus the Bob in quotes of the Subgenius. That to me, it was like, that's the spine of our culture, really. That's like the main line. That's the main dialectic of because there's never only one good way to do art. There's never only one proper response or something. There's always at least two, and those were the two, and they were both named Bob. And they were at each other's throats. And I was like, this is incredible and the best. And it's never stopped being that. It still is that. 20 years later, I wasn't wrong. It still is Bob versus Bob is kind of the running dialectic that
yeah.
is the sort of basic pixel, black-white pixel vision of our culture. But so the point is that after a few years of that, I without getting derailed on the specifics of it, I became massively obsessed and enmeshed in this drama, a subplot drama about that happening in that interval in the popular culture. And I was so focused on paying attention to that, that when Bob was saying, like, Brian, did you hear this incredible thing, this ion, this force has emerged, and there's this new thing, I was basically like, yeah, that's awesome. That makes sense to me because what's going on here is the most incredible eruptions of synchronicity and creativity I've ever heard. It seems to me like the culture is sort of exploding. The popular culture is being torn down the middle right now. So I'm not surprised that some rough beast is being born, but, you know, I don't have time to pay attention to it. I'm like, I'm glad you're recording all these conversations, Bob, because I have no spare attention for it. And then it's just always been like that since then, that it's like, I'm willing to take Bob's word for it, that ion is the sort of number one thing happening right now in our culture. But for whatever reason, I'm focused on trying to pay really close attention to whatever's number two or whatever's 1A. So I can't be a straight face ionaut, but I don't disrespect. I don't disdain the whole thing. I just have to come at it from a weird angle and be obsessed with something else at the whole time.
Are you on the Completement products, Brian?
I'm on the Remag and the Remite and a little bit of Reset Drops. I was only able to get myself one of those. Unfortunately, I've been like a broke guy, and then I was getting myself not to be a broke guy, and then this COVID thing came in. You know, it's that kind of blew out my income, and I found myself in this sort of weird interval since then that I'm, you know, whatever. I like count on. I have a relationship with Slackonomics that I have faith in, and I don't think I'm going to, you know, die destitute anytime soon, but apparently my brief period of being slightly flush was not to continue, and I'm having to cycle back down to not being flush, but I'm like comfortably not flush, you know, it's okay. I just don't have a lot of money to spare on that, but the Remag and the Remite are both so good, especially the Remag. I mean, geez, as soon as I started with that, it was just like, boing, this dramatic, great improvement of certain things that were bothering me and just general good feeling. And I'm never not going to buy the Remag. But the Reset Drops are a little like, I made sure to get some of them, but I can't really keep myself on daily drops.
Mm.
But other than that, I haven't. Oh, and Steve Reimer gave me a bottle of the... what is it? It's like H3E2. I can't remember what the bottle says.
D3K2.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. So I had some of those over the past month, which I presume is very necessary.
Ion says they're almost the most necessary right now.
I mean, yeah, I wouldn't be able to... I can't honestly say that I, like, noticed some dramatic difference about them or something, but I don't doubt that they're good. I love this Completement products thing. And the Completement products thing, I also love, you know, it just brings up the brilliance of the whole Bob versus Bob and AMAP thing as well, because it's addressing people on this AP level of their bodies and helping them, like the ground of your experience that, like, yeah, like, we all think, like, oh, I need to find the person who's going to tell me the thing that's going to fix me. It's like, fix the ground of your being, your fucking body, okay? And anything you hear will do more for you. And so that's just wise. They're great products to help the ground, but it also creates this sort of automatic, hilarious win on the AM verbal, you know, linguistic, dramatic, cultural content level, where, you know, the subgenii it was the it was just like it was just their one note criticism, not even criticism, their one note sneer for so many years at Bob, that it's just like, yeah, well, oh, you're so brilliant, how come no one listens to you, how come you don't have an audience, how come your audience is so tiny, how come you blah blah blah, and you can only even keep that tiny little bit of audience because it's all free or something. Like, they're like, we're a business, we have all these paying customers, and then it's like in a few short years, the Bob and Ion and Carolyn team have, you know, they've just blown Subgenie out of the water in terms of starting a cult and making money out of it, right?
Yeah.
While not even being ironic. Like, the Church of the Subgenius gag is that ultimately it is a con. It's just they provide great content to cheer you through your day or something, but they're not doing anything to help you, and they'll just take your money, and ultimately you're left alone with Bob. You know, hopefully you can suck that shit again and feel good, but you know, it'll run out at a certain point. But you know, and so the Bob and Carolyn and Ion team have created something where it's like, yeah, you send us money and we give you something that makes you, we give you something that actually improves your physical life, and then all the funny comedy content and mind-blowing good lines and stuff, that's all free. Yay. There's that too.
You see,
so it's
but,
a good
so,
sort of victory.
Yeah, so Bert, you see, no Ionaut can talk like Brian, right? Look what
right.
he just said. You know
right.
what I mean? So if you think of an artist, I think it was Arnold Toynbee said there were three kinds of intelligence, intellectual, artistic, and spiritual. So intellectual would be the dull scientist, the sociologist. That's intellectual intelligence. Artistic is original and creative and weird. And then spiritual is probably dealing with the most important thing, your ascension. But back in the secular world, you got the intellectual versus the artist. McLuhan say the bureaucrat versus the artist. So the creativity of the artist, which is wallowing around in this deluded world and making fun out of the mud, that's what artistic intelligence is. And they get all trapped in that and forget to develop their spiritual intelligence. So that's what Brian likes. He likes the artistic thread of human expression. He likes artists and people that fuck within this world. I don't know what Brian would say about his intelligence quotient. Spiritual intelligence quotient. But the so you got people here who might be got better developed spiritual intelligence than Brian in terms of going to parallel worlds or whatever one does, but they can't say anything and they're dull and they can't speak and they're not sure what Bob's on about. So Brian is the artistic wing. The artistic hypnosis wing of the Iondom thing. And that's what he just showed. He just talked for 10 or 15 minutes about all kinds of interesting points about dealing with Iondom, called Bob, in his case. Because he's dealing with the artist of Iondom is me. It's a new kind of art, but it's the artist part. Ion is the spiritual intelligence. I think that's why I want you to hear him. It was a good question, and he explained himself very well. An artist is a narcissist in a way. They're not going to totally give up themselves to some nebulous something. Now, that might be wrong. You might have to do it. And the artist probably is smart reacting to all those and say, you got to get rid of your ego. Because even Ion says your ego is important. You know, you don't get rid of your ego. But a lot of the spiritual intelligence Gutenberg era is about getting rid of your what people today would call their power and their secular power. So Brian insists on being, what do you call it, a stick in the mud. He ain't going to totally believe this, but he likes the satire of it or whatever.
Yeah, I'm stubborn.
Yeah, I got to find out who's breathing there. Is Santa fall asleep already?
Not asleep.
All right. So anyway, so what do you think, Susanna? See, Susanna is partly in the women wing of Iondom. She's partly in the artistic world because she had to do it in advertising. So what do you think of what Brian says? Or have you got any questions or statements for him, Susanna?
Well, I'd like to know why he doesn't maintain his composure with Ion.
Well, who does, Susanna? Who does? Nobody does. Except
That's
for me.
True. That's true. But he's so good writing his posts and just now is very articulate and eloquent. But, well, I guess it's the Ion thing. That's for
well,
sure.
Well, how about Ion? Is that kind of intelligence is more important than any human thing right now? So Brian has to deal with that factor that he is, a doofus. In the long run, if he doesn't get justified with Ion, because that's what Ion's saying. You got to get right with them or you're fucked. So we had fun doing culture, but that's not really the main point anymore.
Is it the X-ray thing that Ion says people are too concerned about being X-rayed by Ion? Because it is true. They seem to know things. Does that keep you from fully broaching anything with Ion?
Yeah, somewhat, I guess. I mean, it's just strange because sometimes the interactions have gone just fine, whether or not I really understand what the significance of the answer is supposed to be. Sometimes I've gotten really good answers. There's been no problem. And, I don't know. I mean, sometimes it's just that what's on my mind to ask about is really not, it's really only of interest to me or something. And it doesn't, and then Ion doesn't like that or just expresses exasperation. And that's fine. That makes sense. Like sometimes I'm just not in the, sometimes I'm just more likely to think of the good questions to ask at any time other than when I'm actually on the phone. Some of it is just this bad timing. Like I used to have this back in the, analogously when it was more about being in arguments with the subgenius people or something that I found that in retrospect, I barely argued with them. And part of the reason was that I was almost, for a long time, it was very hard for me to, I didn't have the internet at my house. And when I would go use it at the library, there was like something about sitting down in front of the computer and actually starting to use the net that would just wipe from my mind everything that I had previously thought I wanted to do on the internet. And then it just became more of like a reacting to whatever I found on, Bon Echo's board or fivebody.com or something or alt.slack or whatever else I was looking at. And so I've kind of had a similar, persistent pattern with Ion where, unless I very specifically anticipate and write some questions down, I usually don't know what the hell to ask. And then often what I end up, oh, what was I thinking about lately? And then I ask is just not really of interest to anyone other than me. And it doesn't go that well. So sometimes I feel just a little bashful that way. Or
right, bashful. Brian, you're actually, to put it in good light, Brian knows to shut up around Ion and listen. Right? You get that,
yeah,
Susanna?
That too.
He actually listens.
Yeah.
He listens. And he knows that what he has to say may be not relevant to what Ion is saying. So the service of what Brian does is he shuts up and listens. If Brian can bring him in and he has to listen. If he doesn't have to listen, like he's on the chat line, then I don't know what he takes in of Ion. But when he actually has to deal with it, he shuts up.
Nothing goes in one ear and out the other.
What'd you say, Brian? Nothing does.
It often goes in one ear and out the other for me.
Right.
I remember the last time you were in Toronto, Bob.
That was 2014.
Maybe it was the second last time. But yeah, not the day that we met on Church Street, but there was a day that we had a very long walk. And you showed me some of the places that you'd lived and stuff.
Right, that was 2007. I think that's before Ion.
No, it was after Ion because I a part of, you were asking, you wanted, this was like you were kind of taking the opportunity to ask in person rather than just over email or the phone, like, so what do you think about Ion? And
we talked about that, eh? Yeah, I remember walking
kind of
along.
My dominant thought. We were walking along Bloor Street. We're at Bloor and Christie, and you asked me about Ion, and I just said, like, yeah, well, the problem is that I have a hard time remembering what Ion said after, like, I listen to hours of Ion, and then I can't remember a single thing that he said. And I don't know, you laughed at that you seem to find that kind of appropriate or something. But
well, no, that's what everybody does.
That's also
first.
Been a persistent problem.
Yeah, that's for most people at first, because they don't know and they haven't heard enough. But if you hang around and you eventually you'll notice something's repeated, then you know they said that. It takes a while to be able to remember it, to know, to remember what Ion's saying. I remember walking around that night, and what could that have been? When did I come to Toronto? I don't understand how that happened, because it could have been 2000.
I mean, maybe I saw you twice on that one trip.
Oh, yeah.
Like maybe we got one night and walked around another night, maybe. But then that would have been, Ion would have been around for like 4 years. It feels like that.
What about 4 years?
Yeah, I don't know when you were up there before. If it was 2014, then Ion would have already, you know, been on the scene for 4 years.
Yeah, and I would have asked you about it. And you always had the problem of the internet. In the early years, you only could come in every now and then because you...
Yeah, that too.
You weren't able to stay with it every week, which you've been able to do the last few years, back then, because the internet was all screwed up. So that could have been 2014.
Yeah, I also didn't want internet in my house all the time.
Right,
know?
Right.
I liked having it as a, as
you were
a
still reading.
That I had to go do.
You were reading.
I was still in
reading books and stuff. So I remember, on Bloor Street, we walked into that Friday night scene, which was intriguing, where the young kids were all playing games. Remember that story? Walk in,
and
play games.
The board game cafe.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have a bunch of franchises now. It's a very successful business.
Is that only part of Toronto's culture, or is that something that was happening other places?
I think that board game cafes are happening elsewhere. It might have been one of the first successful ones that proved that there's like a real market for that.
That was very interesting. All these kids, you know, who would normally be out dancing or something, would go there and get a table and have board games among themselves. There was all kinds of games.
And
it's constantly
what kind of
up.
Board
yeah,
game?
Yeah, because it's kind of...
Every kind.
All kinds. It's like a library. Shelves just full of, you know, all the ones you've heard of and hundreds of others that you haven't. So, you know, you can try out some new
games.
You can ask the server, can you recommend a game? Yeah.
So,
no,
like,
what do you say?
Board games.
I hear board games, I think of chess and checkers and...
Monopoly.
I don't think of
letters.
Monopoly, but then... That's what you're talking about, is games like Monopoly and Chutes and Ladders and
There's a million of them now.
They definitely have everything like that, but there's also a lot of like card games. Like for example, there's this really great. I mean, I was never into games that way, but a friend of mine lately got himself a bunch of decks of that the Illuminati card game, and has come over and played some long sessions of playing this Illuminati card game, and that game's great. It's really fun. So there's a lot of sort of card game role-playing things. There's also things that are a bit more like, I don't think that those board game cafes are really into Warhammer exactly, but there's a lot of games that are more like these sort of a reduced Dungeons & Dragons type of thing that you can have like a fantasy campaign. So there's all kinds of games that,
that's what was amazing. And you went along the shelves and every box I'd never seen before.
Wow.
100 boxes.
So that would mean actual interaction with other people.
Yeah. People were interacting. That was it. They weren't on their phones.
Mm-hmm. Or on home in their computers doing video games and connecting that way. Virtually.
Yep. So none of you people have seen that anywhere?
I haven't. No, not here.
No. How would they make their money, the cafe?
You pay to use the game.
Oh.
And they sold food and drinks.
They sold what?
You'd pay, like, food and drinks.
Food, yeah.
But and you would also, but yeah, it's like you show up and pay like $20 for a table and unlimited games for the evening or something. So.
Oh, okay.
Well, I guess COVID,
I don't know if that's
probably
the price,
killed
but, yeah,
that.
Something like that. Yep.
Yeah. Did you see? Was it empty, Brian? Would have been. Anyways, whether you saw it or not.
Yeah. I think, yeah, well, what interests the question that just leaped into mind right now is I wonder whether those board game cafes have like a sidewalk patio thing going on now, like the bars and restaurants do here. I don't know. I presume that they maybe do, but then board games are, you know, trying to play board games outside, it's much more susceptible. You might lose crucial pieces due to a gust of wind or something. So maybe they don't want to do that. But yeah, it must be tough for COVID. But that particular business, it was called Snakes and Lattes.
Now
have like 4 or 5 franchises around Toronto. So I think that they were doing well enough that they're not going to like go right out of business or something. But still, it's like big rent on a lot of locations if you're not pulling in revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, I guess they're badly shut down by COVID. I haven't, I don't have one of those right in my neighborhood anymore. So I haven't walked past one in a while. Is that true? Maybe it's just been closed. I don't know.
So I want to bring in another point. Go to Dobbstown.com and listen to the interview with Ed Absurdum. Two names, A-D and then Absurd with a U-M on the end. That's Brian back in 2002, me interviewing him, well, maybe a few years later, about
it was more 2008.
Yeah, 2008. Once I got here, I was interviewing a lot of people. Extreme synchronicity bordering on synchrony. It got so, quote, bad that he thought Stephen Colbert, he'd watch Colbert every night or whenever he was on, and Colbert was following alt slack and flyby.com and making a weird mixture of me and Stang's Bob in his commentary. That's what, and Brian would prove it almost every time. Which is a crazy state of mind Brian was in, because I don't think it was happening, but Brian can make case that it was.
Yeah. Well, no, that's the thing. I in retrospect, I was convinced it was happening all the time, and in retrospect, I can accept that it was happening seldom, but it was definitely a few times at least. So it's one of these things where like a little goes a long way, like, you know. The TV talks to you once, and then you fucking think it's talking to you. You're susceptible to think it's talking to you the whole rest of the week, you know? Like, it just spreads from there. Your brain just locks on to that and interprets, well, what if the next signal is also addressed to me?
Yeah, it's a weird
or not
kind
not addressed to me, but referring to these inside jokes. Basically, it was like, why would, like, Colbert is clearly a subgenius type. Why wouldn't he have been a fan of the church at some point? Maybe there's someone on his writing staff who like follows all that slack sometimes. Like, you know, there's a lot of random shit in those shows. So it's also just this hypothesis of like, maybe some of the random surrealism in these comedy shows aren't totally random, but they're some sort of a cryptic narrowcast at someone. And why wouldn't that someone be maybe me once or twice if I'm making waves in the subgenius community for some reason, whether it's because I'm cool or stupid. I don't know. I'm not trying to make a value judgment on making waves, but if I'm making waves, I'm making myself a target. So,
yeah, the intensity of what Brian went through, that is probably a later stage of hyper-creativity. And if it goes bad, you don't have any grace, you get schizoid, paranoid, hysteric, and you're in the hospital.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of artists.
I did.
What?
I hit this, and that's exactly what happened. I mean, I didn't end up in the hospital, but I did end up on the streets.
Yeah.
Briefly, so it was not good.
It happens to a lot of subgeniuses or creative people, and Stang even told me once that at some point in his life, he thought the newspapers were the headlines were about him. You know, Christian Murray talks about the viewer or the subject merges with the object. That's going to happen as you dissolve your mind. So the subject merges with the object world, and you can just see the later stage of that you're not smart about it, and you actually think the object world is out there, and it's actually merged. So you're hearing yourself talk to yourself, but you think the media out there is talking to you. You still think there's a separation, which might be a residue of the Gutenberg effect, you know, a visual bias. So I know a lot of people got to that point of the world was talking directly to them.
I mean, it comes down to this thing of like, yeah, we recorded these conversations over 10 years ago there about extreme synchronicities I was experiencing. And it's just interesting to me because at that time that we recorded those conversations was just as, but especially just before I really leveled up into a crazy new level of experiencing synchronicities, you know?
Yeah.
Like, to me, the stuff in those conversations is almost not really old hat or something, but it doesn't, it really did level up. Like, maybe making those records even contributed to it leveling up, but the sort of synchronicity journey or tracking your Zenocrony journey that led up to that point was almost seems paltry because it was like sporadic and occasional or is intermittent. That like what that Colbert thing did is gave me a taste of the idea of a continuous and potentially never ending intense synchronicity experience, which is very crazy making. You know, it's very difficult to integrate that with, you know, normal functioning. It's a very mystic kind of state of mind. So,
yeah, I think with Ion's intensity, everybody seems at some point think Ion's talking to them, and they really have synchronistic experiences. And I'm saying they don't, but many Ionauts have had Brian, what you're talking about, dealing with Ion, but they don't have any Stang or Alt Slack Church of Genius cultural reference points to translate into. They don't translate into anything other than, well, Ion's watching me. That's where they get to.
Right.
But see,
I got into more of a delusion that other specific people were watching me.
Yeah. And you could culturally quote things, all kinds of things that would fit. So did you see, Bert, did you see I don't know if it was on my site or Explorations, but Brian was talking about the Blue Jays winning the World Series in 93. Did you see that, Bert, a week or two ago?
It was on Facebook.
Right. Where is Bert? Did Bert leave? No, he hasn't left. So where's Bert?
Is he muted? Maybe he dropped off.
Let me refresh.
And call back in.
Oh, yeah, he's under the new mute. I have to remember to refresh. So, Bert, did you see that fake explorations about the Blue Jays and Twin Peaks and Joe Carter or something?
Yeah,
now,
remember that scene. I used to be a fan of both baseball. I remember Joe Carter.
Okay, so that's, you know, almost 30 years ago. So I remember Brian a year or two ago going on about the Blue Jays in 93 and the fact that Bob left Toronto in 93 and the Blue Jays won, though they had won the year before. And then they went to New York, and then New York won the hockey. Islanders won out of the blue. So he was tracking me and where Bob went, the victories went. Now, I wasn't following anything. I didn't even know anything about it. I didn't know. I had not experienced the Expos things. I didn't even know they won. But this time, I watched that thing that he posted. And this, I didn't know that it was a replay of the famous 1960 moment. Bill Robinson or somebody. Remember the guy at the bottom of the ninth? I experienced that. You know, two down, two out, and he fucking hits a home run and they win. the bottom.
Well, yeah, it's because it's the every little boy's dream,
yeah.
Right? And it's the American dream. Like,
yeah.
Every little boy's dream: hit the home run, they win the World Series. But it never happens, or happened twice this century.
Yeah, twice. Mm-hmm. And the second time, I didn't know it was fucking Blue Jays. Joe Carter did it in '93. Bottom of the ninth, two balls, two strikes, right? Couple people on base.
Yeah. Because it was the, to me, it was what the, I didn't know about the, I wasn't focused on the idea. I didn't realize that, you know, that the championships of one sport or another had followed you. To me, I was more focused on the idea that Toronto won the World Series the 2 years that Toronto won the culture by producing the Bob's Mediacology albums.
Right.
You know, that it wasn't even so much about you as about the people managing to notice, hey, like, this guy actually is the shit, and creating some sort of cultural response to it.
Yeah. Yeah, the
a good cultural response.
Yeah, we became...
Yeah, so to me, it was like the Android meme blessed the Blue Jays with the victories, possibly as a, not possibly, partially, I mean to say, that the Android meme blessed the Blue Jays with those victories, partially as a way of kind of putting a wreath on Dave Neufeld's head or something.
Yeah, yeah. To acknowledge the underground, there had to be an overground echo of it. And so they
exactly.
wanted to acknowledge the underground, so they rigged it so the Blue Jays won, and even in the most phenomenal way.
Yes. What year was this?
And that was the last World Series. You know, the next year they had the strike, and
yeah.
then the year after that they had reformulated the whole
I'm
league
muted.
So that because no, you're here.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know that. That's right. It stopped.
Oh yeah.
Well.
The whole point of the World Series, the whole point of what makes the what used to make the World Series so fascinating, was that the two leagues. Like the, you know, hemispheres of a brain or something, the two baseball leagues were completely separate. They never played each other.
Yeah.
So, like, you would go through your league and try to win your division and then try to win the championship of your league. And then after you won the championship of your league, you have to go play this team that you have never played before. You can't possibly have played before.
Right.
You know, so you have no experience against them, and they're like a foreign entity, right?
Yeah.
But then, so 93 happened. Joe Carter, Toronto won it in the most dramatic way possible. The next year, there was a strike, so there was no postseason. And then the year after that, they had reformulated the whole league to introduce interleague play during the regular season so that, you know, it might be that the team you face in the World Series, you had already played that year and, you know, you were already familiar with facing
yeah.
their pitchers and you were already blah, blah, blah. And it's just,
never knew
it.
Well, that would take
the
charge
beauty.
Out of it. The other would be gone. That's like Rai returning
yes.
to essence. And since I was on, talking
yes.
about the radio for five or more years, they had to
yeah,
act it out there.
The separateness was
gone. Because you're right, it was very dramatic to have two strangers meet.
Mm-hmm.
You probably didn't even think of that, Bert. It was just part of your unconscious of the appeal of it.
Yeah. Well, it's
and I mean,
baseball's great. I mean, you know, two out, you know, two strikes, last part, ninth inning, and the smack a home run. That's a dream, like Brian said. That is a dream.
And it was fun watching the guy.
Yeah,
I think when I first watched the footage, Brian, I just saw him. He was running towards first, but he was watching the ball,
yes.
and then he saw it went into the back, so he started leaping. So he leaps all the way around the bases. You know what I mean? Into
yeah.
the crowd.
His leaping was pretty crazy. It wasn't very elegant. It was very ecstatic.
Yeah,
you know,
and then he dives into the home plate. Everybody piles on him and almost kills him. Okay. So then I said, well, that was neat. Brian thinks that's pretty neat. Then I found out, holy shit, it was the bottom of the ninth. Like, it took me a while to get all the factors that were going into it. And then I would watch it again and again, and I said, wow, that's the ultimate thing. This guy, Joe
yeah.
Carter, I'd never heard of him. I'm starting to think, what is Joe Carter? Can we get any metaphor out of his name? If you got any, Brian? What?
Oh, he's JC. He's JC.
Oh,
he's
Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ.
That's right, right, right. JC, for fuck's sake.
Yeah. Well, okay, no, here's the here's the really weird thing about it being him, too, is that, yeah, they won 2 years in a row, right?
Yeah.
The year before, they won it, but they didn't win it. The winning game wasn't at home. They were in Atlanta. But the bizarre
thing... Atlanta, SJW.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But the funny thing about that was that, you know, Joe Carter was an outfielder. Or sometimes he would be the designated hitter or something, right?
Yeah.
But in Atlanta, when they won it, for some reason which I completely forget, Joe Carter was playing first base.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
When they recorded the when they recorded the final out, it was again. Years it was Joe that was the face of it because he was the guy on first that took the throw.
Oh yeah, the pitcher, the bunt. They stopped the bunt.
Yeah.
I think it was a bunt.
And it was Nixon. Nixon did, huh? Jumping up and down. And in retrospect, it's like, why the fuck is Joe playing first base? I don't even remember.
That was the World Series with Blue Jays and Atlanta, the Braves?
Yeah.
Series.
Yeah, Toronto
versus
Atlanta.
Wasn't there
Atlanta,
also
yeah.
an infamous, something happened, I think it was with Atlanta and the World Series, where a fan caught the ball, a foul ball, and it could have been an out for the Blue Jays.
Huh.
And they were playing in Atlanta, and the fan... caught the ball before the player could catch it. And so it was a huge mistake
robbing
out the game.
Yeah.
I don't remember that specifically. I'll go back and have a look at that. I don't remember that. What I really remember from the Atlanta series was that this is what really tied into the I'm not into this whole story, don't worry, but what launched into me, because I was a big Jays fan, and then I forgot about them after, when they went on strike the next year, I'm like, okay, so I'm going to be a teenager instead, and then I didn't think about baseball for 15 years, but part of what got me back into it was this crazy callback to the weird shit that happened in that Atlanta World Series. The very first time, it was like a big symbolic deal, right, for the Android meme or something. The very first World Series game of America's pastime that took place not in America, the very first game that took place in Toronto, these fucking American, soldiers or whatever came out carrying, I'm getting mixed up. This didn't happen in Toronto, but in that World Series, these fucking soldiers who came out carrying the flags, they had the Canadian flag upside down. And people were like, how do you do that by accident? Like, what the fuck kind of insult is this? Like, is this some sort of, like psychic warfare to try to make us lose? Like, you're coming out with our flag in distress? Like, you know, so it turned into this weird thing. But then the Jays got a triple play in the World Series, which almost never happens. It's only ever happened once before. But then... the fucking umpire called the last out safe, even though he was clearly out, so they didn't officially get the triple play. So it created this tension, which has been, to me, this is like a really juicy dialectic ever since then. What really happened versus what was recorded in the official, like, book of life. Really happened in physical reality, the Jays got a triple play.
Yeah.
But... and everybody knows it. No one denies it because it was obvious on the replay, right? But you can't, at that time, you could not go back and overturn a call. If the umpire got it wrong, they just got it wrong and the play was fucked. So it got recorded in the book of life as not a triple play, but everybody knew that it was.
Mm-hmm.
So just creating that weird tension where officially it didn't happen, but everyone knows it happened, you know, that's kind of like this weird Emperor's New Clothes pattern that's like super fundamental to our whole culture of just cognitive dissonance makes the world go around. And then it was the next time the Blue Jays got a triple play almost 20 years later. And the crazy, I'm not going to get into it, but the incredible coincidence of the timing of that got me back into being a Jays fan.
Right.
Specifically on a like synchronicity obsession tip.
Right, because that's 2008-09 when you're right in the middle of this extreme synchronicity. I was going to say
Well, 2012.
Oh, 2012, okay. So the I can see the tensions. The first time a Canadian team can steal the World Series. That was a big tension,
yeah.
Right? And so,
yeah.
Right, they were insulting this intruder accidentally probably. Or unless there was the Sinaloan cartel was in there, nobody could acknowledge.
I have a hard time understanding how you could, when you're the like color guard and it's your job to get all these symbols right. It I don't understand how you
it's
could.
It's a simple maple leaf.
Accidentally hung their flag upside down.
Yeah,
yeah. It tells you whether it's upside down. It's not like, oh, I didn't know which color goes against the bar. Like
it's one
it's
color.
A clearly oriented object.
So you get that, Bert, the tension. It's some weird non-physical tension was screwing up people's minds. You weren't getting
that's
it right.
The thing. I was 12 years old, and I was just like, this is the greatest thing ever. The Jays won it. But then, you know, it was only later that I looked back on that, and I was like, whoa, that was when there was like this peak, like there's a real, the culture war between the U.S. Church of the Subgenius and
yeah.
the Canadian
yeah.
Bob, you know, the American Bob and the Canadian Bob, like there was real tension at that moment, and the Canadian Bob won!
That's right. Remember, it's the year we invaded. We invaded the States on February 15th, 1993. Joe Dunn Sloan died a few days before. Stang freaked out that day, wrote a letter to Stang, not knowing we were showing up. So we walk into Jerry Fialka's home, and he checks his mailbox outside. And as we go into his house for the first time to stay there for indefinitely, 6 months at least, he says, oh, we got a letter from Stang. That's what greeted us in the fucking home was a letter from Stang excommunicating
awesome.
Jerry from the church. And Jerry wasn't a member. He never was that interested in it. But because he got me on KPFK and those shows, Stang objected to me having been on American media, so he blamed Jerry and excommunicated Jerry. But it's all a big laugh. We were laughing ahead. What a great entry, right? And you're right. The war had started, and that was the first skirmish right there on the first day.
Brian, have you
and
ever
it's,
thought
it's
about
funny
documenting
too, the...
all of these Bob links? Have you ever thought about...
No, he does it, and it's in his memory. If we just get him talking, he'll it all... That's why I did the interview with him. A lot of
wait,
them
wait, in... you're recording all this, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Shit.
Write it up. I got to write it all up sometime.
Yeah, you have done parts. You probably could, I would go, Brian, back and listen to the interview we did in 2008 or so, and then that will spark you, get you in the mood, and you see what happened there.
Yeah.
But
there's various strands. Yeah.
But Brian, but
so
you,
go ahead.
If you save your posts, you occasionally do this. Like, this is what he did. He suddenly burst onto the forum saying, showing Joe Carter and Twin Peaks and something in Twin Peaks related to Bob and Mike. And how did it come into today? What had happened? The Tibetan pitch or something that Dale Cooper was
right.
doing.
Yeah, there's how it came into today was I was just at the Dome the other day. I was just at the Dome on Sunday to see a game, and I mean I knew this was going to happen. Like, this is the thing. It's like, this is the thing. It is a very, like, it will ruin your notion that the world is, you know, a dead place or something. Like weird miracles will disrupt that notion.
Yeah, right.
But the weirdest feeling is when you expect something kind of like miraculous to
yeah.
you expect
yeah.
a coincidence, and then it happens, and you're like, why the fuck did it, how did I, you know, like
yeah.
Anyway, I just knew it, that I'm like, yeah, this guy Miguel Cabrera, he's like one of the greatest hitters ever. He's been on the Tigers for 10 years. He, when I got back into baseball in 2012, I was saying, partially because of the, like, mostly it was triggered because of this Blue Jays triple play that got me into the, like, hey, this is a really fertile ground for intense synchronicities, and it ties back into my, like, inner child, so it's got lots of psychic potency. In 2012, when I got back into the Jays, there was also this whole vortex around this guy playing for the Tigers, who was winning the Triple Crown, which no one had done in 44 years. And there was a big vortex tying into Eminem and Marshall McLuhan and Mars, and the face on Mars being a tiger, and Marshall McLuhan has tiger blood, and the MC from Detroit is Marshall Mathers, and Charlie Sheen talking about tiger blood and all this crazy shit, and this guy winning the Triple Crown as a tiger. So that was like a big, that really solidified by like, holy shit, the world of baseball really resonates.
Well, Brian, did you see what I added to it?
Yeah, that McLuhan met
Wyndham Lewis
in Detroit. Perfect. He was the guy he got it from.
That started in Detroit, 43. When I see Brian's stuff, I have time to read it because I'm going to focus on it. So I finally got time, and I read it earlier today. I said, wow, there's a Detroit connection. Now, Michael Edmonds came from Detroit, and he was very involved with it. I'd stay at his place in the 2000s, and he was a triple agent or something. But he never could get on the Ion thing. But anyways, Detroit, McLuhan was down in St. Louis. His mother was in the Detroit area. She was cultured enough to know, wow, this famous Lewis guy is in the area. So she went to a talk or told Marshall a talk was going to happen, connected to the father, Stanley Murphy, at the University of Windsor, which was Assumption University back then, and Chad's growing up there. And she says, Marshall, this guy you talk about, he's speaking here. And McLuhan immediately got his buddy Felix, and they zoomed up there, and he met him. And that started a whole thing that ended up 10 years later to be a novel about all that meeting in 1954 called Self-Condemned. Lewis interacting with McLuhan in the novel. So Detroit, so I thought you'd like that, so I'm glad you saw it. I threw that in.
Yeah, definitely.
The show.
And he calls that place Mamaco, which is a play on the suburb of Toronto that's called Mimico.
Mimico, right.
And yeah, so that's, you know, my name right now on the...
You're a Mimico.
Mimic Mass.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You did that because of... Lately or before what you just said? When you changed
I did
your
it
name.
Because of lately, because this guy who, you know, was in this, the baseball player who was involved in this really intense, I was just like, oh my God, in 2012, I'm like, what? And it's late 2012, right? It's like going into the postseason and stuff that this guy wins the Triple Crown. He's involved in this crazy coincidence with Charlie Sheen and Marshall McLuhan and Marshall Mathers and Detroit and Tigers and Tiger blood, Tiger face. McLuhan's tiger circulation, all this stuff.
Yeah, his life.
Yeah,
McLuhan
like, this
survived
is...
surgery in 72 or so because his body grew tiger's veins, literally, and brought blood into his brain, saving his life. And then he didn't have to have surgery.
Yeah. That brings up the issue of like, the software infinity of the Android meme can create endless, you know, hypnotizingly fascinating synchronicities almost effortlessly.
Yeah.
But that's an AP miracle of the fucking body.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Miracle. It's an ionic spiritual intelligence phenomenon because Marshall was he concluded that the nuns praying for him caused that. They grew it.
Right.
So that was McLuhan's secret spiritual superstition kind of thing. And so actually it's ionic, this whole story, this recent one, because of that factor of the crazy growing of another animal's veins in Marshall's neck. That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And it comes back.
Because tigers have them, Carol. Only tigers. You have to understand, tiger's veins were grown in a human being somehow.
Yeah, because it was his carotid artery was collapsing.
Yes.
So they're like, oh, shit, your brain's going to die with no blood. But then right before they did the surgery, they're like, actually, your brain is getting plenty of blood from this other vein that usually humans don't have feeding their brain, but cats do? Holy shit.
Yeah.
Good job, buddy. You managed to avoid surgery.
McLuhan mutated himself.
But this is when it comes back to, you know, there's AM. This is why I like the baseball, where I'm like, oh, the baseball's in this great interval between the AM data
meme
coincidences. Yeah, the Android meme data coincidences versus anthropomorphic physical, you
projection
know, fact of the bodies and the physical world coincidences. Because, you know, there's this thing like, you know, one of the one of the easiest, one of the sort of kindergarten level of conspiracy theory is that pro sports are rigged, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, yeah, that's true. Like, at least some of them on the level of, you know, and it sometimes is really blatant because they obviously the fix is in and they have to do it one way or another. So sometimes it comes down to a really blatantly thrown play or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But the point is that it's one thing to be like, yeah, you can throw a game, right? It's one thing to deliberately play bad.
Right.
It's harder to deliberately play good. And then it's like comes down to this question of like, how much is rigged? Like, maybe there's rigging that goes on every day to make money off of gambling. I don't know. But that would be more about like who ultimately wins the game, right? But I got more interested in these like individual events that can't really be faked, right? Like you can't, you know, if you had an agreement with the pitcher, maybe you could hit a home run on cue, but you can't hit it to a specific spot that's like 2 meters wide, right?
Yeah.
Not deliberately. That you need luck playing assistance to do that.
Yeah.
So when those coincidences happen, I'm like, that's not a mere human conspiracy.
Right.
So I've just found the world of baseball to be a very and there's just so much slack in the fact that they play 162 games every year, you know, like football is like
12 games.
It's like all rigged.
Yeah.
there isn't any room for any non-rigged shit going on in there, but like there's just so much room for bullshit to happen in baseball that like there's lots of slack for weird miracles. But the point is it's weird that it's just weird to go to a game knowing like, because I knew for a long time that I was going to be going to the game on Sunday. And then I heard like a week ago or something, or a week and a half ago, that like, oh yeah, that guy Miguel Cabrera, who was caught up in that crazy coincidence back in 2012, he's sitting on 499 career home runs.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh yeah, he's going to hit it the day that I'm there.
Yeah, you knew
definitely.
That.
No chance he's not. It's just too perfect.
Yeah.
And so sure enough, he goes a week and a half without hitting a home run. He plays the two, you know, he was playing a long homestand. All the home fans are like, come on, hit it at home. And he doesn't get it done. I'm like, yeah, of course not. He's going to do it in Toronto. He's going to do it on Sunday. He plays two games. He plays two games in Toronto, doesn't do it. And the game that I'm at, and the whole weekend, he looked like crap. He couldn't get a single hit. But then sure enough, the game I'm there, boom. He hits his 500th home run. So I get to participate in the big standing ovation of like, yeah, your career is awesome and we appreciate you, you know, like, and I'm standing there thinking like, man, no one appreciates you the way I do from that crazy sink vortex in 2012.
Yeah, you're there. Wheel of Bob like, hears this. We'll report back to Bob what happened.
Yeah,
that's very good.
No, it's weird. I mean, that was the second, you know, the Jays were not in Toronto for a year and a half.
Yeah.
Which sucks because I really like them. But the great thing about it, the fucking silver lining is that because this is the secret, right? Yeah, I dig the Blue Jays. I dig baseball. What I really dig is that fucking stadium.
Yeah.
That was what I first got me interested in the Jays. I only got interested in baseball because I was like, holy shit, what is this building?
Yeah.
And, you know, anyway, so the point is that when I finally got to the first game I went back to see, I told my sister and her husband, you know, and before the game, I'm like, Vladdy in the sixth. That's my prediction. Sure enough, he hits a fucking home run in the sixth. And then the next time
wow.
I go back, it's the Cabrera home run. So it you know, when you get to that level of synchronicity, it's just really weird.
Yeah, it's a kind
it's
of secular
communicate
power.
How fucking weird that is.
There's a secular godhood there.
Yeah.
He's
oh, yeah,
triangulating.
I calculated
Bob.
That one.
Yeah, triangulating.
I literally calculated that prediction. I'm like, because it was the 33rd inning that they were back. Oh,
right.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't get to the point. The silver lining of them being gone for a year and a half is that that building, that temple, the Sky Dome in Toronto at the foot of the Great Spire, that is the only one of the stadiums that did not have to suffer the extreme indignity of playing games in front of no fans at all.
Hmm.
Every other fucking team stadium had to suffer that indignity except for Toronto's because they were exiled. They were homeless. They were like, oh, well, I guess we're going to play at our minor league park. Yeah, shit.
And why
no,
were
I
they not
Canada.
Playing
well,
for a year and a half?
There
they
were cardboard
barred from
cutouts.
Canada. They were
fans.
Shut out.
What? No, no. Brian,
know,
why did they not
That's
play
even
for a year and a half?
Darker than no fans. They played. They just didn't play in Toronto because they were banned from it. They were not allowed back into the country. Or visiting teams were not allowed into the country. So,
why?
You know. Because fucking COVID, man.
Oh, they got stranded? They get stranded in the States?
Yeah, the Jays played in 2020 and the first half of this year. They played all their home games in Buffalo and Dunedin, Florida. Ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Crazy. They were the exile Jays. They were homeless Jays. They were couch surfing.
That's pretty
but they wanted to play, so they stayed in the States. If they would have been in Canada, they wouldn't have played at all.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they had to play somewhere, and they weren't allowed in Canada. So it sucked, but the ultimate silver lining is that the temple in Toronto did not have... Because they used to do that as a punishment. Like... It literally happened where, like, teams were punished by the league by saying, like, you're not allowed to have fans at your next game or something, like, as a punishment, you know?
Yeah.
So now every other team had to endure that punishment, but the Jays endured not so much that specific punishment of their home stadium with no fans, but they just went on a different ordeal.
Right.
So, you know, I like that. But, yeah, I could really ramble along about this. Thing, so we should probably veer off.
So explain the Twin Peaks pitch, which is another thing. That's not connected to the Joe Carter thing, is it?
No, this is connected to you, buddy.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the thing. You, right? This is part of the, like, you know, the like, well, we can't take Bob seriously. Like, sure, he might understand McLuhan or something, but he's fucking psychotic and he thinks everything's about him and he says these crazy things that just are repellent and I can't, blah, blah, blah. Like, well, motherfucker says Twin Peaks is all about him. You can go, I don't know if any of you, I don't know who, look, this is the thing. I don't know if, I suspect that Ionauts very rarely spend any time in Studio C. Listening to those archives,
yeah,
you really should. They're fucking fantastic. And the CKLN archives. And one of the things going on in there, and some of those shows, is you talking about, people are like, Bob, have you seen this incredible new, brand new show, Twin Peaks? Because it's 1990, right?
Yeah.
They're like, have you seen this show, Twin Peaks? And you're like, yeah, it's about me. It's about what we're doing here. And your main rationale for, like, there was all sorts of stuff that people found resonant, but the main kind of undeniable coincidence anchor that people could sort of hang their hat on was that that show revolved around this weird supernatural dyad of Bob and Mike. Right?
The guy,
and
the one arm
show
guy.
Was the Bob and Mike show. Right? Bob and Mike dyad. So you were like, yeah, it's all about Bob and Mike. So, yeah, okay, it's easy for your average, like, cynical subgenius to consider that to be just like a embarrassing psychotic projection, but you know what I noticed rewatching this scene, because there's a famous scene early in the Twin Peaks where Cooper does what's usually called a Tibetan ritual, because he talks about Tibet in the same scene.
Yeah,
but it's not Tibetan ritual, it's a baseball ritual. He fucking measures out 60 feet 6 inches, which is the distance from the mound to the plate, and then pitches rocks at a bottle, where he's like, he goes through the lineup of suspects, saying their, like, he like closes his eyes and whispers to the rock in his hand the name of the person, and then throws a pitch, and then it's like the time that he throws a strike and breaks the bottle, he's like, oh, put a mark on that suspect, they're a person of interest, right? So it's like,
yeah,
this,
so
hilarious baseball,
the local sheriff was fascinated, this crazy FBI guy coming up with these strange ways of doing stuff, right? Strange rituals. Yeah. Who got picked?
What I only just noticed, like, last month,
yeah,
you know, this is a famous scene. Everybody loves this scene.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons people fell in love with Twin Peaks. It was one of the early episodes.
Yeah.
People saw that. They're like, this is so creative and interesting. I love this. And I loved it, but what I didn't really notice, I didn't hear it, I didn't twig to this until just recently, that Cooper, when he's explaining what they're going to do, he's like, Laura wrote in her diary, I'm nervous about meeting Jay tonight. So today we're going to focus on the Jays.
Oh,
and then I was like, oh, shit, right, that's because there are other baseball details in there. It's not just the 60 feet, 6 inches, right? There's a guy wearing gloves. There's a warm-up. There's this other stuff. And so I'm like, oh, the Jays. That's another. So then my question is, so what I then immediately wonder is, holy shit, is that just another way, like, that they included, like, three subtle redundant references to baseball to, you know, so that people would notice that this is a baseball ritual?
Yeah.
Or was it underlining that there is a secret Toronto subject going on with that Bob and Mike thing?
Yeah.
Could it be that the reference to the Jays in the early episode of Twin Peaks, could it be that that reference is the confirmation that, like, yeah, as crazy as it sounds, this show is about what's fucking going on in Toronto there on this radio show with Bob and Mike, right? Because he also, right in that same scene, he's like, oh, yeah, the casino, it's across the border, Canadian side.
Yeah, the Jacks. What was it called?
Yeah, One-Eyed Jacks.
So,
yeah, and the logo of One-Eyed Jacks lines up with the Jays logo at the time. Their chins, the angles of their chins line up. Which is weird. So
okay, so your new insight about that was the Jays. They had not noticed about the Jays.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that brought in the baseball in Toronto. And then that was done first. And then a week later, the Joe Carter thing came up, which was about the Jays.
Yeah, then you posted that. And
oh, I did that.
And
yes,
I commented.
Oh, there
something.
It is. I accidentally posted this thing about this how did I find out about it? Didn't you post the...
Maybe I got you thinking about the Jays by posting that video. I don't know.
Yeah, and I looked at it. You were a nostalgia for it or something. So I looked at it, and then I discovered it was a very important event. I mean, it's the only second time in the history of 20th century baseball that the bottom of the ninth miracle happened. I didn't know it was only once or twice. But so if you go back to... When Don McBurney, Carol and I, and Jerry and a bunch of us went to Tobago, 1st of April, we're there for a week or two, and then we get on the plane, and that was a real problem getting on the plane because it was all clogged up and I got lost and it didn't even look like I was going to make the plane. But I get on at the last minute, and I pick up a Time magazine, and there's David Lynch on the cover, who I was always interested in. And it's all about the beginning of Twin Peaks. He had just done the first episode, and everybody thought it was great, so they put him on the cover, and I read a little bit about it, and that was that. And then people would bring up Twin Peaks, so I come back, and we're on the show from April 90 through to, going into the summer, and then all of a sudden someone pointed out to me, not much said about Twin Peaks, Bob, you should watch it. It's being replayed. So I watched the first episode, and at a key point in the show, Cooper stands there and he goes, he's just wondering what he's going to do next. So as an interval thought, he goes, I wonder if Marilyn Monroe's murder or death had anything to do with JFK. These are the two things I think about always. You remember the line, that thing?
Yeah,
about Marilyn Monroe?
Definitely.
And I'm going, holy shit, that's Bob Marshall's mind. I said, when I saw that, I said, this is about me, for fuck's sake. And then it just kept each week. After a couple of the shows, I was building up a case. It was about us. And then Mike, the one-armed guy, it really helped cinch it. And then there was actual objects in the show that were in our house on the wall.
Oh,
it just kept piled up. So every week I'd come in and explain the proof of what I had just seen. Now, real people have been into the Twin Peaks. They already knew they'd seen the show and they weren't watching it. But I was making them think about it by doing it in the summer when nothing was happening on the Twin Peaks till the fall when the new season would come. And so 3 years later, when we get to Jerry, he had a kid living there. And to give the kid something to do, he told him to go through all the archives of me and Mike and put together all the talk of Bob about David Lynch in Twin Peaks, because they were going to go to a David Lynch show in a week or so in that area in Venice. And so the guy made the tape, and then they went there, and Jerry got to present the tape of me explaining Twin Peaks in my terms to David Lynch. So he got the tape.
Uh-huh.
He actually got the tape in 93. And
marvelous.
Yeah, so I start, and so then the next thing is the movie, what's the one where the guy is, he's a guy in a house, and he phones Bill. It's Robert
Lost Highway?
It might have been Lost Highway, yeah. Remember the guy would be in another place, and he'd phone Bill, who'd be at a party, and the guy was there.
Yeah, he's in two places at once.
Yeah, two places at once. So I was watching it in New York City, and I never experienced what happened. So we were there, and the crowd was watching. And then some weird thing of two people in places happened, and some guy in the audience, some New Yorker, goes, "Come on! You can't do that!" he objected to the fucking story that Lynch had gone beyond normal narrative possibilities. He was cheating.
Yeah, he jumped the shark.
Yeah, and I thought that was the neatest outburst I ever heard. So, come on! You can't do... Typical arrogant New Yorker. They brought everything, right? And he objected to Lynch.
Yeah.
And that's when Lynch started to go crazy in his movies. Well, he was always doing it, but Lost Highway, and then The Two Brothers, and then Mulholland Drive. And there was more and more Bob stuff in each movie. And so I thought that maybe he got a bit of guide on it by listening to the recording. He consciously started to put it in there.
I mean, this is the thing, right? This is where this speaks to what I was trying to talk about the Colbert thing, right?
Yeah.
There's like this, there's an immediate revulsion to the idea of like, well, this famous person is referencing me, you know, but it's not fucking impossible, you know,
yeah.
Like if he got your tape and was like, he doesn't have to be like, oh my God, I'm in love with this Bob. You know, he could just be like, whoa, this is a really weird fucked up guy. He's totally crazy. But like, wow, I'm entertained by how he thinks it's about him or something.
Yeah.
And then maybe he would go get Bob's Mediacology. Maybe his favorite part of the album was when you did the reverse radio show.
Yeah.
And are like, bring, bring, I'm just cold calling people to be like, did you ever think about the fact that when you're on the phone, you're in two places at once?
Ah.
You know, so maybe he's like, that's brilliant. I love it. I'm going to put this in my next movie. A guy who's in two places at once via the phone.
That's what happened.
Why not?
Yeah.
That probably inspired, and that's one of the most iconic horror movie moments of the 90s, right?
Yeah,
like everyone is transfixed by that scene. It was probably inspired by you.
Yeah.
So, that sort of thing, like, it just really strongly undermined the, like, chorus of cynics on alt.slack or whatever who are like, look at this psychotic who thinks that he inspired shit. I'm like, it's believable that David Lynch was inspired by Bob. Like,
yeah, they don't know what
like
gave him a
chain of custody that adds up.
Yeah, the subgenius guys don't know the extra facts that were part of it.
Right. And so here's the other thing, right? So you were claiming in 1990 that the Bob and Mike thing might have been a reference to your show, right?
Yeah.
Now, when The Return happened...
Oh, my God.
Right? When The Return happened...
25 years later.
Fucking 25 years later, when The Return happened, you've got Dr. Amp doing his show, and he says, we're coming to you live and electrified, which is a pretty strange word to choose for that moment. And you always said, this is the electrified voice of Bob Marshall.
Right.
Then, and in Twin Peaks, Dr. Amp says, coming to you live and electrified from Studio A.
That is a series, you guys.
He's only got one house. Why is it Studio A? Where's Studio B? Why is he referring to it as Studio A? There's no explanation of that. I'll tell you what the explanation is. He's fucking confirming that it was always about Bob.
That's right. And remember, the opening scene in episode one of The Return is Dale Cooper. We don't know what he's done in 25 years. He's talking to fucking Ion. That's the opening scene.
I remember saying that. I remember you outlining that. I remember that. Yeah.
No, that's pretty incredible. Mm. Like, what has Lynch been doing? He's following Bob's career, and he's an Ionot. He's going to say this. You want to know what happened to me? Here's what happened, people.
it creates a situation where, to me, it's kookier. It's literally kookier to claim, like, oh, Electrified in Studio A? Well, that's just a coincidence. Like, no, actually, yeah. It makes a lot more sense if that's just a reference to Bob. Like,
yeah.
As long as you get over the, like, celebrities are in another universe and there can be no communication between them and us. Like,
yeah.
If you get over that fallacy, then it just makes sense that it's a reference to your show.
And so you go to
even if he's just trolling you, even if that doesn't mean, even if it doesn't prove that the rest of the show is about you, even if it's literally a troll to be like, I'm going to say this and that Bob guy is going to go fucking crazy over it. You know, maybe
and
he's
his
just
accolades.
Amusing himself.
Yeah,
I don't
his
know.
Accolades.
But it makes way more sense that it's trolling you than that it's a coincidence.
Right, right. And then you get the freak episode 8. Which is total bizarreness, the whole episode, and I recognize it immediately, well, you know, pretty soon, it is the expression that Lynch could come up with of these other forces and worlds in our world when Rai returns to the plane of essence. Well, it starts with Rai coming in. Episode 8 is the Rai coming into our world. He's showing the Rai drama in actually a good way, or appropriate imagery, because everybody said, "What? That was the weirdest thing they'd ever seen, that episode."
Mm-hmm. Bob, maybe it was the rip.
Yeah, it could be a replay of the Rai Return to Essence as an afterimage of the, which we call the rip. That's right. Well, that's what the chart is. The chart is an afterimage of the Android meme. The whole internet is, in a way, a rip. But we didn't have that term until lately when I brought in to explain November. But what does the final statement in episode 17 or whatever? What is the last thought? It's about there's no time, which is the main thought of Ion all the time.
Right. What year is this?
Yeah, he says something. He goes, "What year is this?" And that's the end, right? Isn't that how? That's the last word.
That's the last line of dialogue.
Yeah.
Yeah, after that, Laura screams and the lights go out and it's over.
Yeah, so he goes, "What year is this?" That's a Bob particular who knows all the years for everything, right? But when he encounters Ion, no time gets rubbed in Bob's face, so he has to recognize, well, we're not sure what year this is anymore.
Right.
Especially since everything in a neutrino levels already happened and everything's unfolding backwards. So it people were disappointed with that ending. Some people were, anyways, when they first were doing it. But in the Bob world,
well, the last episode was infuriating, right? People were like, "Okay, this is the last hour of Twin Peaks ever," and he spends like a full third of the episode. It's just like riding in a car with nothing being said. Like,
right.
It's the most incredible troll. It's like this weird anxiety meditation of like, get to the closer! And just like driving. Like, do something. Like, we only have half an hour of Twin Peaks left.
Yeah.
What is this driving for?
And what that does, though, that's mirroring Iondom. We spent, 31,000 approximately record hours. 30,000 hours of it. It's a waste of time of Ion jerking off, telling jokes for every stupid TV show, driving in a car with nothing going on.
Yeah.
It was a total Ionic fucking replay, that last episode, of what we've been doing for 12 years.
Well, I never watched it, but it said that he was possessed by the evil spirit known as Killer Bob. That is funny. Of course.
That wasn't so obvious in 1990, but I knew where I was going.
We
don't emphasize too much about the Killer Bob part. Well, back then we didn't, but I knew I was, because I would go on the show on the station and kill DJs. I'd offer, I'd say, "Come on, I'll kill you." And I would do it verbally with some way. Basically, I'd give them a new idea that they never thought before, and I called that a death.
Oh,
yeah.
Killer Bob.
Fry their minds. Mm-hmm. Fry their minds on
words. Yeah.
You're right.
You'll hear that in the archives. Well, not, no, you don't, because I go on another guy's show, and he never recorded it. So it was just anecdotal, but it happened a lot. I did everybody almost.
Oh, wow.
So that's what's uncanny. Who would believe 30 years later the dudes involved with that on CKLN are now have the best talk show going, Office Hours. They're still going.
Yeah, they're going. So you got multiple talk shows. You got three shows now.
Yeah.
And they're all successful.
Oh, yep. They're all unique.
So now that it's firmly established that, you know, the Jays have some connection to you and that the Twin Peaks has some connection to you, the funny fact is there is not David Lynch. He said something about playing baseball as a kid, but he probably doesn't give a shit about baseball. But the other co-creator of Twin Peaks, Mark Frost, is a huge baseball fan, right? So he probably was responsible for the baseball elements in that scene.
Right.
And not only is he a huge baseball fan, but his nephew is a major league pitcher.
Right.
These days. He pitches for the White Sox. And Mark Frost's nephew, his name's Lucas Giolito, is pitching against the Jays tomorrow at the Dome in Toronto. And I'm going to fucking be there to witness whatever the fuck happened.
Right. And you're going to wake up tomorrow to see if you get intuition of something's going to happen that you can predict. You don't know yet, but might.
Yeah. Well, a walk-off pole shot would be really appropriate because I mentioned that. He wrote a book. Mark Frost wrote a whole book about a World Series game that it wasn't the whole World Series that ended with a walk-off home run, but the game ended with a walk-off home run that hit the foul pole. So it's this like perfect maximum tension of like, is it going to be the ultimate victory? Or is it going to be just another strike of a foul ball? Right. And then doing it hits precisely on the border, which is fair territory. And yay, we win. So
the pole thing? I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, the foul pole. Sorry.
I know. Game is this? When did this happen?
Carlton Fisk was playing for the Red Sox. He was like a big star and hit this big home run at the end of this game. It was game 6 of the World Series of 1970-something. And Mark Frost wrote a whole book just about that game, but I presume he gets into the whole season in the book. But the game ended very dramatically with him, you know, hitting this ball. And then it's this kind of iconic shot of him like trying to wave it fair. He's like doing these gestures of like trying to sorcerously influence the ball to stay fair. And then it hits the pole and he leaps in the air and it's this great moment. So, you know, that would be the coolest thing to happen.
Carlton,
but it would also be cool if someone hit a home run to me that I could catch.
Right. Like Brendan there in the Lakota Nation, he gets Wee Jot 69 written on the ball. Wait till you see what's written on the ball when you get it. You'll probably say, where's Nigel?
Cool boy.
Who I've been wondering lately. What happened to Nigel? He's not posting much in the McLuhan world.
He's around.
Is he doing on Alex Kuska's place where I'm not allowed anymore so I don't get to see him?
No, he's not participating in that. He reads Facebook, but he doesn't really engage with it very much.
He was for a while, but something happened to him. He had nothing more to say.
Partially just a profound disappointment with that scene and maybe a feeling that there's not much point in participating with it.
Right. Okay, so the poll. So Carlton, was he the guy, he was a pitcher waving it, or he was the batter?
He was the hitter.
He hit it.
He was the hitter.
And he's trying to guide it to stay in line, to stay in position, and it just barely gets there by hitting the interval, the pole, and that's consistent.
Yeah, by hitting the boundary.
Right.
Yeah, because that's what I was saying before about, like, yeah, I don't doubt that they can rig who's going to win the World Series or something, but you can't. You could even rig it that, like, it's going to be dramatic, okay? Here, we're paying you the money, or we're going to kill you if you don't do what we say. When it comes down to it, you throw that guy a meatball so he can hit a home run, okay? Okay, right? Like, great. But you can't fucking dictate where it's going to hit to, right?
Right.
Like, you can't say, like, and then you hit the ball and you hit it on this fucking, like, half a meter wide object that's 350 feet away, okay? Like, no, I can't do that on command. So, to me, hitting the foul pole with a home run or bouncing it off the top of the outfield what I call boundary bombs,
yeah,
the ones that hit precisely. To me, that is a very significant unriggable event that portends something.
Yeah.
And I, like, look, let me tell you, I have never had this feeling before, and it surprised me when it happened, but I in 2019, I attended a Jays game where a guy bounced a home run off the fence, and I fell to my knees. I was so astonished that I got to witness that. That's so fucking rare. Like, I actually just, like, dropped, like, involuntarily. Like, my jaw, not just my jaw, but I fucking fell to my knees. You know, like, oh, my God, it happened. I saw it. So, like, I've seen the wall bouncer. Now I need to see a pole shot sometime. And this might be my last chance that I can go back to the Dome because, you know, it's my beloved place. But they've announced now that the next time the Jays come back, you need to be vaxxed or at least have a negative rapid test, which, like, costs money, and that's like a surcharge on a ticket that makes it too rich for my blood, even in the cheap seats. So this may be the last game that I can attend. So hopefully I'll get to see that pole shot.
Okay.
But it's funny because the Toronto Stadium doesn't have poles. It has nets, which is significant, I think. But
okay, so listen to this. When you said the word pole, look what happened. In this Lewis book, I'm reading the introduction, and it's going over each writer's short introductory of what their essay is going to be about. So the guy I wrote, Alan Mutton, I know him better than Paul Edwards. His essay, look at this. Mutton's point of departure is the usually ignored fact that Lewis's writing is notable for his frequent use of quotation. My fatty commune is nothing but quotations, right? Lewis's pages are spattered with words and phrases between quotation marks, and his critical books are full of repeated discussions of extracts from the work of others. Quotation is Lewis's way of confronting this. After surveying briefly the history of the discussion of Tumbo Mutton, he reviews the history of these two writers, Frege and Carnap, they wrote about this quotation factor in writing, in literature. Mutton turns to Donald Davis's essay called Quotation, 1979, which argues that quotation is demonstrative. I don't know what demonstrative means, but maybe it's a grammatical term. I think I remember it in grammar. But that's not the point. Then it says, Mutton's discussion of Lewis begins with the short story, The Pole, 1909. And I'm looking at this. This is very early, 1909, and he's not even known. And it says, where the quoted word shows that the central protagonist is not really a pole. So I'm there looking at this, trying to figure out what it is. The pole's in a quote, and it's inside another quote, and I don't know the story. So I'm puzzled by it. Then it says, this figure is a teller of stories. So the pole is a teller of stories who likes to quote both his own earlier words, that's me, I quote my own what I said before, and those of his interlocutor. Quotation reveals him to have a divided personality. Then, you know, the code of a herdsman, the famous Lewis Manifesto.
Oh, yeah.
The code of a herdsman, written in 1914, published in 1917, develops the implications of this self-division for the intellectual and artist. Remember, I was just talking about the intellectual intelligence versus artistic intelligence. Mutton argues that the divided self is crucial throughout Lewis's work. And this is your divided self in relation to spiritual intelligence. And that it signals cultural disorientation. In his manifesto Blast, quotation is used to mark a critique of public language. In Lewis's developed theory of the 1920s, his discussion of the French sociologist Alfred Fouilly in The Art of Being Ruled of 1926 has both public and psychological purposes. Mutton discusses Fouilly in relation to Gerald Siegel's The Idea of the Self, some book in 2005, in order to argue that Lewis's view of the self was relational and mutual. Okay, that's an interesting phrase. But pole has been in my mind. It's a recent puzzle, right? What the hell is the pole? Not sure I understand it until I read the story and then see who's the figure and who isn't the figure and why is he called the pole in quotes. Anyways, all that comes back when you mentioned the pole, which is the ending point before you go in to meet your maker tomorrow, your last final thing.
Yeah, and it makes sense that it's a Lewis reference. It's not it's not bringing up some other thing. It's the loop ties into that.
Which
Detroit
is what
project.
My point to your post was that Detroit is where Lewis met McLuhan. You know, so the Lewis is part of the punchline here. And then I don't know if you heard me. I read the end of the essay where they decide that Lewis, because everybody was so fucked up about politics in the 20s and 30s, Bakunin even said that art got distracted by the political intrigues of fascism, communism, and everything. But we would say radio, as the new collective ESP, it screwed up Gutenberg Arts. It was too new and amazing, right? Everybody's engaging in the radio phenomenon, and everybody took it into a chemical body political battle. So that's what screwed up art in the 30s. And Lewis was in the midst of it, too. Pound went nuts. Everybody kind of went crazy. Joyce was the opposite. He went crazy by being so passive. He just said, you know, let Hitler take over. That's what he told his friends. Don't fucking resist him. You know, imagine that in the middle of all this. They're all fucked up in this radio effect, which is the LaRouche quadrant in my Android meme chart. The first replay of analog media is radio. That's the LaRouche quadrant. So they start explaining that everybody missed that Lewis was really involved with anthropology, with music, with cinema. The mother of one of his kids leaves London and goes to New York and becomes the first woman major employee at the Museum of Modern Art in charge of film. And she comes from hearing all about film from Lewis. And she becomes the famous leader, the creator of that department in the Museum of Modern Art. And it was a big deal to decide, is this new stuff, is this art? You know, the individual Gutenberg of the 20s, that sensibility, didn't like this collective mass media stuff. It can't be art. Mm-hmm. You know, it's too much stupidity in it or mass emotion. So the woman who kind of figures it out comes from Lewis. So they're explaining there's all these other things about Lewis and what he wrote about that he was very comprehensive, way beyond anybody else. And they say, it may be, look at this, in the sentence, Paul Edwards, the other guy I wrote to, he's a major Lewis scholar. He gets the establishment gigs, like does the Yale University dinner table book, you know, coffee table book with all this great stuff of Lewis and paintings. Edwards goes on to suggest that the postmodern aspects of Lewis's modernism derive from these effects of his war experience and provide a ground for modern criticism, meaning today, realization. We realize today that Lewis's work has a relevance that seems to be outlasting that of his modernist associates. In other words, he's outdoing Joyce and everybody. They were half understandable in the 20th century, but nobody could get to the McLuhan level of Lewis, and he also anticipated Harold Innes. So I remember when I was at their conference in 2014, one of their themes was Joyce won the 20th century. He's the big guy that everybody made a big deal out of. But Lewis is more relevant to the 21st century. So these Lewis scholars want to make him make a Lewis industry like there was a Joyce industry in the 20th century. So this sentence expresses this is what they're doing. This is what their agenda is. And these guys are three professors in Birmingham. That's where this Lewis cult is. And they say Lewis's work has a relevance that seems to be outlasting that of his modernist associates. And so they then say the contributions to this book reveal a Lewis who is much more than an individualist insisting on a solitariness and autonomy. And then they talk about how Lewis engaged with everybody all across the board, all parts of society. He was talking to everybody, which is exactly what I do via radio. I integrate or talk and relate to everybody and avoid the ivory tower that de Kirchhoff and them and the academics get into, right? I even pick up this street psychic maniac from fucking Atlanta where there's highway signs saying J.W. Dobbs on the street.
Right.
And we bring in Ion, who is secretly the second coming, sneaking in through the bars and pubs and nonsense of a G-radio. You know? This is so I see that's what Lewis did. He would talk and interact with everybody.
And that is, I mean, it's very, what you were saying about the film program and just this eternal, you know, this eternal fucking debate about like, oh, this latest thing, can it be art? You know, that's perfectly in line with, you know, what McLuhan did with ads.
Yeah.
Right? Like he followed up on that. So it's like, in a way, I'm, you know, whatever, just following my nose and finding myself doing something similar with, you know, possibly the stupidest pop culture phenomenon there is, which is stupid sports.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing dumber than rooting for your local team, right? Or less highbrow. so
and you're engaging in pattern recognition down in the gutter with nonsense.
Exactly. And pattern recognition and highbrow pattern recognition, because it's not just like, oh, you know, baseball can be art or something, but I'm literally like, look, in this weird 2020 season where everything's fucked up and the schedule is so weird that the Toronto team, Canada's team, they call them, are playing a home game in Washington, D.C. and what happens? There's a player on the Toronto team whose name is Bob, sort of. His name is Bo Bichette, right?
Yeah.
It's Bo B. So he's Bob, even with the, like, big B, little O, big B, like that weird way that they would spell your name sometimes, right?
Yeah.
So he's Bob. He plays for the Jays. There was this the one weird – I was like, something weird is going to happen in this game. You've got Canada's team are playing as the home game, as the home team in Washington, D.C. stadium against Washington. Washington are having to play as the visitors in their home park. This, something fucks up going to happen. And you know what happened? A wild swing, because this is the wonderful thing about this guy who's Bo B.
Yeah.
He's the wildest swinger, man. When at his standard swing, he like staggers across the plate and has to keep himself from falling over. Like, he's crazy, right? So he gives this wild swing that on the backswing, the bat hits the umpire in the head and draws blood. You know, the umpire's like, oh, you're on TV. They're like, holy shit, he's bleeding. This old man, like, is bleeding from this blow to the head. But he was fine. But the point is that umpire was like, Joe West. He was a JW. So Bo B cracked JW in the head and drew blood. So to me, I'm like, yeah, I mean, I perceived that, you know, there's lots of good cooperative, synergetic vibes between Bob and Ion, or Bob and JW, but there's some friction there too.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, I was like, wow, we're bringing back that Canadian-American thing again. Holy shit. Bo B cracks JW in the
head.
That's
good.
Wow.
Very good.
So to me, that's like, that baseball game rose to the level of art in the sense of it reflected, it provided an echo of what's the real thing going on
in the
culture
ground.
Of the Bob and W interaction.
Yeah. And now imagine you bump into Kirkhoff someday. And you try to explain this incident to him. It's just not going.
Let me buy you a coffee, Derek. I got a lot of stuff to explain. Yeah, right.
Right. Okay. So, so the comprehensiveness of Lewis, and you know, and McLuhan was the same way. They objected to snobbish cliques, basically, and that's what I do. I want to go around and show up in places you're not supposed to show up. So it says. The Men of 1914, yes, that was Joyce and Elliot, the people on my tiny note chart, was one significant group in Lewis's life, but he got involved with all kinds of other people. And it's the other people and what he did and other things we are now going to focus on. So they say he made big contributions in aesthetic theory, the creation of literature and art, that'd be the drama of cognition and how creativity replays that, contributions to popular culture. The one they don't know is he created McLuhan and Innes, ideology critique, political debate in the public sphere, which he saw as the guarantor, the guaranteeing of a pluralistic society, which I'm going to say is a quadriphenic society, and then how he said, we've got to continue some kind of hierarchy in a post-letters world. We've got to retrieve the values of the Republic of Letters, which would be autonomy in relation to the hive mind, because that was the last precarious refuge of the civilized intelligence. But and that's the battle in the Emerald Tablets. The first battle is the first enlightened people had to deal with the crummy assholes in the tribe. They're called the Dark Brothers, right?
Yeah,
you can't.
Right.
And so they always the shaman always lives away from the tribe because the other guys that he grew up played baseball with don't believe his nonsense. You know what I mean? They don't believe
exactly,
he's any different.
Yeah.
Can't be a prophet in your own village, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that pattern. So Lewis is really hitting the key issue here about how do we maintain the Emerald Travel tradition of not getting lost in the muck that leads to death and lack of ascension? So I'm calling that quadriphenia. So I I was wondering when to write this person, ask what's the status of my membership. And then I read this last night. I said, this is it. I can brag about Quadrophenia and the point I made in July 2014 about that he is the Benjamin Spock for the 21st century. I really believe that if you took that quote and you taught to high school kids and you point out to them maybe the multiple bodies and that, it's not that hard to get, especially for their generation.
Right.
They would have a way that would get them out of all the conceptual debates of left hemisphere, right hemisphere politics and all the stupid categories. And where did this word categories come up today? Ian was saying about, that website that Bert found. It had all these categories. Right, Bert?
Hmm.
You remember that, Bert? He's still here? Yeah, Bert's still here, I think. Multiple categories are what is the dust that gets in people's eyes, as McLuhan said. The new man is powerless to be born because of that gets into the cradle. It looks like Bert. Bert has gone.
That's an amazing quote.
Yeah, do you know it? Sound familiar?
No, that's. I don't recognize it.
Yeah, it's
very.
It's in the. You got Counterblast, 1969.
That was the last one that I got, but I don't have it anymore because I lost all that. But
right. That quote is in the beginning of that book. I think
cool.
It's his introduction
the
about...
The new man is powerless to be born because the dust gets into the cradle?
Yeah, I'll in a minute or so I'll go out and get it and I'll read it. He ends, I think, the Lewis... His introduction is how this is a replay or a counter to Blast, and the printer of Blast that Lewis had was an alcoholic, and they had to give him all kinds of alcoholic to even do it because it was too weird with the graphic innovations. The fonts and design was really hard for the guy to do, and he wouldn't do it. He thought it was obscene or something. And then I think McLuhan ends the essay, a little introductory essay, saying, and the problem today is that the dust of the information society gets in the eyes of the baby new man in the cradle trying to be born, something like that. Anyways, all this Quadrophenia, more and more, and then to see on the cover of this, I'd never seen this before, he's actually saying that he's Diogenes, which is what Eric says is the definition of a Manichaean satirist. You follow the Diogenes cynical philosophy. You know, the guy who you heard me say at the beginning of the show, Diogenes went around with the barrel. He was naked with a barrel, and he had a lantern, and he was looking for an honest man, you know, in Greek society.
That's funny. That's a great shtick.
Yeah.
I like that.
And so he says that's what he does. He sits on the sits by his tub and throws invectives at everybody who walks by. And that and McLuhan did that. And maybe I do that. And Ian definitely does it. So and you know, Bruce Powell, who wrote about Lewis and all these guys, he said, Bob, your show is redoing Lewis. And that's not what we need today. We need more kindness and compassion. And so he demanded me to delete Ion putting down one of his student professors on our show because I read what she said about something. And Ion went at it, and he heard it, and he thought that was terrible. We were hurting the girl's feelings. And I think that you can't – I was thinking about what is different about Ion or about our time in spiritual intelligence. We're moving to a world where everybody has to be a warrior. And so the feminists started talking about being warriors in the 80s with Starhawk. This warrior thing is the new paranoia, hysteria, schizophrenia that people incorporate in their evolution, what they think they're doing as becoming a more ascended people. But they may not use that word. Now, McLuhan says in Gutenberg Galaxy that the blur of the Gutenberg effect, the visual society, was the soul and love capitalized. They were this emotion of, trying to be sympathetic to everybody, like the Salvation Army archetype. That's because the printing press made everybody fragmented. So they had to balance that by being a little extra compassionate, inhumanly love people. So that was the big ideal of Gutenberg Man. Now everybody's a hive mind. They're totally fused, and they're trying to get out of the fusion, have a little private space or something. So they call that developing your warrior self. So social justice warriors, right? They're redoing the 60s as warriors.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Although some of the warrior aspects have quite decisively flipped into to their total opposite, like,
yep.
You know, that you're a
they went
a
back to
warrior
being
for your war, you're a snowflake warrior or something.
Right,
you know,
right.
You're a warrior to protect your snowflakes from any kind of harsh experience.
Yeah, you
might enable them to be an actual warrior, like.
Right, and what they are preserving is the afterimage that they can't get rid of, their Gutenberg visual bias. The Western world can't get rid of it. So they're being warriors about protecting the love soul part of people. And that means everybody has to look alike and be the same and allow any weird individual eccentricity within it. It's a replay of individualism of literate society up against the nationalist homogeneity that made everybody conform too much. So it's a complex mixing of forward and backward directions here.
Yeah.
So that's about as best as you could say it. You got to figure out what I'm getting at by getting beyond what I'm saying, which is what McLuhan quoted Joseph Conrad. I'm above all trying to get you to see. Well, it's not hard to see something, you know, if it's there. But if it's not there, it's very hard to get you to see something you can't see.
Yeah. But yeah, on that vein, I feel like kids these days might be students these days or something might be much more, they might be very receptive to the metaphor of multiple bodies.
Yeah. I think they are.
I feel like, yeah.
Anybody look at Dimitri or anybody who comes here, Clinton, the younger people get it. They know that's what they grew up in, and they didn't know they had lost their chemical body.
It's just a good alternate metaphor to express a similar thing that, you know, McLuhan used spaces.
Yeah.
But to talk about
different
bodies
spaces
instead.
Right. No, really. That's it. So I didn't know we'd talk so long, but if there are any smart people
here. Oh, yeah.
Does
anyone else have questions?
Yeah. Any questions?
We're supposed to be answering questions.
For what we're talking about?
You know.
You better come up with some.
Yeah, I'm not into baseball, but you mentioned you're a writer. Is that? Or Bob mentioned that you were a writer?
Somewhat.
Well, Brian writes on the forum on Facebook.
I'm not a published writer, really.
Yeah. Oh. Okay.
Although I've had 10 words published,
field.
But sorry, what were you going to say?
No, not in the publishing field, or just, you know, just
no,
just
not
for fun or something.
Well, Brian had ambitions to write, but then he met us and he met McLuhan, Church of Genius, and he realized the traditional writing, like even Norm Mailer admits the novel's irrelevant. So Brian had to wrestle with the post-writing world with a writer sensibility, so he writes writerly posts on Facebook.
Right.
Which you have to take time to read.
Every
time you see a Brian post, you go, oh, fucking ignore that. That'll be all take 2 hours to figure out what he means, because he goes into all these nuances. And maybe he's improved, but they were very bad 8 years ago, and all slack. They were crazy. As a matter of fact, it was interesting.
Yeah.
You would have a lot of psychology, literate billiard ball interaction, where I see what you're doing, but you see what I'm doing, that I see that you're doing it, and you're doing it. You remember how you would overlay these things?
Yeah, and I didn't express it very well. Like, I expressed it as if I was writing as if my audience was myself rather than the people I was talking to. And I would, it's more like, oh, if I could just teleport back now, you know, I could just slaughter, I could just kick the door of alt.slack down and murder them all in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I know how to talk that shit now.
Yeah.
I didn't,
right.
Man, I was totally incompetent.
No, but it was complex. You were. It was the writerly dilemma, which, as McLuhan says, the writerly era, the novel era, was about psychological connectives and disconnectives, mm-hmm. psychological billiard balls. That's what novels are about, mm-hmm. individual billiard yeah. balls clashing. And so you brought that.
I still
want
to write my novel. It makes sense that I had to take like a 20-year detour through the woods of, writing is obsolete, right?
Yeah, you still have to figure it out. But you're doing it on your posts, like Scott Talkington, he thinks he's got to write this big philosophical opus. I said, well, just take all your posts you've done the last 3 years that nobody cares about because they're too philosophical and ridiculous. You don't have time to think it through. And just collect all those together, and you got your little book. I don't know if he's going to do that. He did announce a couple weeks ago, I know I've made a breakthrough. I have got it. I figured it out. But I'm not going to tell anybody because you fuckers will steal it.
Yeah, that's a recipe for dying with your treasure trapped in your own head. Yeah.
Did you see him do that? I think you and some people told him.
I think
him,
so, yeah.
Yes, just fucking post it, but he can't because he needs to make money. So he's trying to make his big attempt at 72 or 3 years old to get something out there, to get a book contract of writing and make some money to survive his old age. And so he's really trying to figure out how to do it. And in a world that no one's going to care, it'll be too complex, too old-fashioned, and he'll have to use our
stuff. He should have just bought a bunch of Bitcoin last month.
Yeah.
When it was low.
But it was
it's
very
not low
funny.
Anymore.
He was asked, pleading for people. He was looking for community. He says, who could suggest some solutions to my dilemma? Which is unique. That's where we've gotten. Imagine James Joyce say, well, I'm going to write the greatest novel. I know it's going to be the greatest novel. Could somebody tell me where I should do it? Who should publish it? Even though you fuckers, I'm not going to tell you what it's about because you'll steal it. That's crazy to get to that point before you publish your big thing.
The thing. It's like if your idea is truly, really kind of groundbreaking, then people can't steal it.
Right. They can't do it.
They won't be able to perceive that it's valuable until you do it.
But now, wait a minute. Nowadays, you can. There's so much mediocrity stuff that goes to the top of the charts because people stole things. The biggest seller of 10 years ago, The Secret, was ripping off the Abrahams. The woman who wrote it ripped off the Abrahams. And it got up there closest to the Bible in number of sales.
It also just comes down to this thing where it's like, I feel grateful for having kind of cut my teeth on the Church of the Subgenius because the whole point was that I recognized that Subgenius literature were the cutting edge philosophical texts of the 20th century. That they not only were they up there with like Derrida and Baudrillard and whatever, like they beat them.
Yeah.
Better. It wasn't just some fucking joke. Like it's actually like there's very profound shit in there that works, So like
and they had access to popular culture like Lewis did. They didn't make themselves snobs. They were open to anybody could join.
Exactly. Yeah, and that was a big advantage. They weren't confined to expressing themselves in this very kind of refined or whatever
artistic
mode.
Clique, which are all kinds of them in New York City.
Yeah, but like part of that is that part of what I'm grateful for is that it's just like part of the message is just abandon your fantasies that your valuable ideas are going to,
the world
like any, or just anything that's popular, anything that's really good is not going to become very popular. And anything that's very popular is not going to be very good or something like some sort of basic that there's a fundamental incompatibility there, that the world of the normies, the normal world, cannot have the best they can get is a severely debased, dumbed down version of your good thing. So it's like, okay, they ripped off the Abrahams, but the Abrahams were never gonna become a bestseller.
They did eventually.
It's like you have to be indifferent to being ripped off.
Yeah.
This comes down to the idea there was some other thing where I don't know. I was just thinking, like watching the like Paulo Granada's
Monday
McLuhan festival thing on his birthday.
Yeah.
The it's like I was really thinking about this thing where, you know, I thought it was cool. Like he had Margaret Atwood on there, right?
Yeah.
Margaret Atwood's pretty cool. I like particularly, you know, she wrote, there's this lesser known novel of hers that I consider to be a dystopia that's a lot less well known than The Handmaid's Tale, that's pretty relevant for our COVID world,
yeah,
to me, the lockdown world. And, you know, I think she's interesting and stuff. But like, it was just kind of really weird to see the way that her appearance on that thing was, because whereas other people with less of a profile were at least to some degree having like a discussion, her segment was just a kind of a managed PR pageant for,
yeah,
her latest project.
Yeah.
And there was zero attempt to like, hey, Margaret Atwood, let's get your thoughts on the current situation or something. Like, as it just, okay, coming to this thing where like she's considered someone who has worthwhile creative insights into the present, right?
Right.
But it's the idea is that whatever insight she has to be like doled out very carefully, right? Because she's only got like one or two or something.
Yeah.
And that it would be rude to put her on the spot and say either like, hey, come up with something new and creative, improvised right now that's valuable. It's like, well, I don't do that. I carefully prepare it and then release it. You know, it would be rude to put her on the spot, and it would be rude to ask her to sort of like spoiler whatever insights we're supposed to buy from her latest book. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
So like, it's this sort of like anti-slack thing where it's like, yeah, you've got something to say, but because it's limited, you have to be so stingy about how it comes out. Whereas if you've got the more slackful mode of having something to say, then you're more like you. It's like, okay, let's just open it. We're going to create 12 hours of content, and I'm going to create as many new insights as I can for free. And there you go. And just react and give commentary, you know? So it's like, it's just a fundamentally different mode. Like when you get to that level of popular stuff, even when it's quality, it's so fucking stingy.
Yeah.
You know, that like, it's just the same way that like even The Secret is stingy as hell, probably compared to the Abrahams. I'm not really familiar with the Abrahams,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But like, it's like what the popular culture can rip off is really limited. And
that's
so
right.
It's just like, she probably has slack as a person, you know, like I'm not trying to say she's like pink or something, like with her friends,
right,
like when she feels relaxed, when she's not like being her, when she's not representing her reputation, she could probably be pretty brilliant. Maybe she could come up with lots of great insights or jokes or whatever in an evening. Right. I don't know. I'm not trying to judge her. I'm just saying that like when you get to that level of popular icon, it just becomes very unslackful and stingy, and it's just antithetical to, you know, the kind of whatever is going on here.
The reason is she represents the Gutenberg meme, the lofty,
yeah,
individual billiard ball intelligence, the creator of isolated works out of their own brain. So these guys are closet frustrated writers. And I called to Kirk up and them. They're the fourth school of media ecology, the diasporic school. They're all trying to retrieve the book, and they bring a book archetype on, and they're all bowing at her and showing their bias, that's what they really respect. And they're not going to put them into this fake electronic dialogue or hive mind pitching back and forth, tactile-wise. So you see, she was forced,
yeah,
to be the Gutenberg icon, which is what she's there,
yeah,
for. She's there,
yeah,
to be the publishers, you know. After World War II, said, okay, books are obsolete, but we got to keep the myth going, the meme going, that our culture is important still, our book culture. We grew up on the book. So they've hoiked up stars in literature all the way through the last 50, 60 years. Icons, and there has to always be one. They have those various prizes, the Booker Prize, this prize, that prize, and they're all a bunch of snobs or... They just disappear and every now and then put out a book that everybody's supposed to be impressed with. it's a Gutenberg after image that they're celebrating there, which is what...
Yeah, or that even if you genuinely are impressed with it, that the sort of like organic expression of that being impressed and maybe getting a response is suppressed.
Yep.
You know, it has to be this very formalized PR dance.
Yep.
Instead.
So we avoid that.
Which is all that is just like, yes, just being paralyzed by the previous environment. So
yeah.
Like this art, this insight is subordinate to turning the wheels of the fucking commerce, you know, of the old environment. Like,
yep.
It's supposed to fund all this other shit.
That's why they have school.
It's not there to just freely spark minds on a free conversation. It's supposed to turn these very specific old wheels.
Yeah, so the creation of the Margaret Atwoods ruins the schools because it makes the teachers believe in these archetypes and they make that the model of the best student. You will someday be so creative, you'll write a great novel or something. That's the ideals in school.
Yeah.
And yet they can't live that way in daily practice, so they're all just texting and doing computer shit, ripping off Wikipedia, and accomplishing nothing. And then the hive mind tendency of each generation wanting to have identity now decides, so we're going to be Carter Phoenix and have five identities every 6 weeks because that'll make us different from you know, the teachers and the parents. So that's where you get this craziness of the woke people celebrating their individual eccentricity, but at the same time, they all have the same political point of view, which is based on, I don't know what it is based on,
It's not even a point of view. It's much more,
inclusivity.
It's much more like contingent on the days.
Everybody must be included. If you have a competition, everybody gets a trophy. I mean, where did that crazy idea come from? Well, it's not crazy if you understand media dynamics. It's exactly the hive mind that McLuhan predicted in the 60s. So you're going to have the group mind, he says, take over. So the kids grow up in more extreme group mind, you know, 50 years later, and where you really have to be careful that you single out an individual, which this society is based on. Capitalism is based on private ownership, private skill, private talent. So they can't be anything. So they can't be relevant. So we have to wipe it out. So we're bringing the aliens in. That'll stun everybody. And we'll start a whole new dynamic, which will be very weird. Apparently, it includes leaving and giving up the Earth.
No, I love the idea. I love the idea that, like, the aliens show up and it's just like, well, yes, the aliens, it's cool to, you know, meet the aliens and everything, but really the important thing is that they made everybody stop.
Yeah.
Like they made, you know, the record scratch, like, and the whole culture, like, snapped to attention to, you know, they managed to do that. That's even more impressive than being aliens.
That's right. And it's Bob's Mediacology. I was saying the other day, the world has all become like Bob. You must be like Bob. What's Bob doing? He doesn't go anywhere. He doesn't go to restaurants, movies, nothing. Does nothing. And everybody's being forced to live a nothing life. And Ion sends JW TikTok, and he sends it to me. So the latest one I got today was Governor Jim Justice of West Virginia has announced that too many vaccinated people are dying and are back in the hospitals. And this is bad, and we don't know what we're dealing with. So everybody had some extreme lockdown. Everybody's got to die or commit suicide or something to save the people in the hospitals. Somebody did a little skit on that we're going to shoot the vaccinated, the unvaccinated, to save the health of the vaccinated.
Yeah.
So you kill people to save the other guy's health.
Yeah, it's going to be mass murder for public health. Yeah, for sure.
So, again, that's the Gutenberg image of public uniformity. There's some visual space out there, herd, that we must save.
Well,
on behalf of that, we will... What?
Yeah, but the governor of Hawaii is locking it down.
Yeah, everybody's locking down. And so Ion said to me, JW said, it has begun. So I called up JW, I said, which direction has begun? Because we're going in all directions. And JW said, I take it as the huge deaths that are happening with the Delta. their prediction, you know, 1/3 of the world will die in the first phase. He says that's starting now. The hospital's being flooded with everybody dying, whether they're vaccinated or not. And you can't use those categories anymore. So they're going to make everybody panic and do the mask and whatever else, they social standing or whatever they think saves everybody. Super gets vaccinated every 6 weeks with the booster shots. That's going to be the effect of this huge panic when everybody is dying. You're not going to be able to stop it.
Jeez.
Well, since they said FDA approved it, more people are going.
You're too blurry. Start over again, then. You're too blurry.
Oh, when they said that FDA approved it, and now more people here in Arizona are going for the shot because they said FDA has approved it. But then something on Ian and Bob.
That they didn't approve it. You see,
no, they just said they planned to approve it.
Yeah, that was good enough.
They approved something other, you know, like telling the caretakers about the myocardial something and other precautions, but not.
But see, the big point, man, is to realize this is the nature of the tech body. It's going to create massive confusion. Nothing will resolve. No issues, no points of view, pro or con, will be resolved because the tech body is going to keep bringing up other data to counter whatever you thought was established yesterday. So that's where we're at, and that's what's going to be. Endless confusion. Which is fitting its way. Go ahead.
The issue of having approval for the vaccines, which is weird because are they approving all four of them at once or what? Like, I don't even know. But
Carol says just Pfizer. Just Pfizer, says Carol.
Okay, right. Yeah, it's the most popular one, eh?
Yeah.
The issue of some sort of official final approval of the vaccine, to me, I see that as a distraction from the fact, you know, people are talking about whether the vaccine's approved. What people don't realize is that the labs which do the sequencing, which says, like, oh, this case was Delta and this case was not Delta, those labs aren't approved.
Yeah.
Are you aware of this? Are you people aware of this? Like, it's another thing where it's like, yeah, vaccines are supposed to go through years of testing before they're approved, right?
Yeah.
Same thing with labs doing their sequencing of telling, like, they're just like, this is the thing. This is the new science. It's like, follow the science, but the scientists are like, it's too hard, it's too work, the bar we have to clear, oh, come on, who has time for that?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's all bullshit, man. Like, it's all, the medium is the message, man. It's the fucking testing technology and the fucking sequencing labs that are not meeting scientific standards. It's just the same old respiratory, like, we don't really understand why people get sick. We don't really understand how transmission works. It's the same thing that always happened, and they just rebranded it and have introduced this permanently confusing testing technology to make us think there's something new happening. There's no fucking Delta variant. There's no fucking novel coronavirus. I could be wrong.
No, here's where you're wrong.
That is my understanding.
You may not have heard Ian define what it actually is. It's mRNA, and he gave a very detailed description to either Carolyn or to me or on the show of this weird bizarre. Do you remember that, Carolyn? Was it last week? He described the mRNA is so weird that nobody understands it. And that's what's killing people, not a virus, not the vaccination or anything. It's the interaction of this weird mRNA. Sense. So do you remember that, Carolyn? Can you attempt to explain that? Do you remember hearing it? Oh, Carolyn doesn't even remember this. Jesus Christ, my backing is defected. But no, I heard it, and you can ask Ian now if he has something to say about it. But it is very complicated what is happening to our bodies due to this mRNA. Remember the genetic thing would come in, Carol? Maybe I wrote it down in notes. I'll look it up, see in my notes if it's there. But Ian is not saying it's a virus. Remember, you were there when we did the Baudrillard thing. Ian agreed that it's a weird mixture of the electric circuitry and our biology. So It's not
true enough. No, but I mean, I also don't, you know, I mean, whatever. Like I say, I could be wrong. Ion may very well. I accept that Ion has access to knowing shit that I don't know. I could totally be wrong, but as far as I know, the way I see this playing out is that, you know, there is no shortage of very conventional, straight-laced arguments against mandatory vax, against vaccine passports, against everything that's going on.
Yeah.
Very conventional, not spectacular, middle of the road. And that all the stuff about, like, the spike protein is going to kill everybody that gets it, like, that, to me, that is a campaign to try to brand the vaccine resistors as fucking crazy extremists.
Yeah.
Whereas if all the vaccine resistors were just on the middle of the road, like, sorry, is informed consent not important anymore? Like, if that was the only issue, there's no fucking argument to that. The anti-vaxxers would win. But when the anti-vaxxers come out saying, like, this is a radical depopulation agenda and half of you are all going to die, well, then you've just handed them their excuse to ignore you and call you crazy and say that you're a menace.
Right.
Like, that's the way I see it. Like, the Masons or whatever, the Illuminati, like, you know, I don't know. I just keep going back to this old Monty Python sketch where they explicitly had this amazing sketch where it was explicitly presented as Masons and how are the Masons corrupt? And it presented these two different architects that are presenting their proposals. And the one guy thinks they want a slaughterhouse. And they're like, wait a minute, are you proposing a slaughterhouse? And he's like, yeah, is that not what you wanted? And they're like, no, that's not what we wanted. We just wanted a block of apartment flats. And he's like, oh, well, I'm a slaughterhouse guy and blah, blah. And then he reveals that he, like, badly wishes he was a Mason. And he has all these conflicted, like, angry feelings towards them. But he also wants to join. And they're basically like, oh, okay, thank you. Get the fuck out of here. But then the next guy, who is a Mason, his apartment building that he proposes is a death trap. But they're like, great, let's build it. And, like, sure, we'll cut corners. People might die. We don't give a shit, right? So it's like, to me, this was like, you know, these guys, Monty Python, they came from Oxford and Cambridge. They know the fucking Masons. Like, they are not ignorant of this shit.
Yeah.
To me, this was their sophisticated way of expressing, like, yeah, the Masons are recklessly indifferent to your life. They will happily make money off of something that will kill you, but they're not on a mission to kill you.
Mm, right.
They're not looking for a slaughterhouse. They're just looking to make money off of some cut corner shoddy shit.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe they're wrong or whatever, but, like, I just come back to that as a touchstone of, like,
well, here's what McLuhan
said about
that. This
whole radical depopulation agenda, it only serves to discredit.
Well, here's what McLuhan said about that.
There's much better argument.
Listen, he said that we knew, he and Carpenter, that everything in the world was second rate. So we decided to do something first rate. Now, why is everything second rate? Because it's for those, you know, Mason, these very stupid people who have an advantage economically or something, so they can lord it over others. But they're mediocre, so they do lousy jobs. They do second-rate shit, which people think was intended.
Right.
No, they just couldn't do anything first-rate. So everything they do breaks or fucks up. Now, that's my answer to what you're saying there. But I'm looking through my notes, and 2 weeks ago in the private session, Ian says the Delta variant was completely pre-planned. And you remember that, Carol? Completely pre-planned.
Makes sense.
And he didn't go into it, the details yet, about that. But it's pretty – so there is something they were making, and they planned it to be this way, and now they're putting the virus in our food. The virus didn't work. Too much resistance. So now they're going to put the poison in our food. They are determined to poison people. They really believe they got to diminish the population. That's what Ian says. So it may not be wrong to say that they're out to do it, but they don't – they're not really sure how to do it. They're doing it second rate.
I mean, shaking the tree so that the sort of like 5% of people who are on the verge of falling off anyway fall off faster. Yeah, that's the kind of depopulation I see them kind of going. I don't really see them going to, like, we're cutting down half of these trees.
Right.
I don't know. That's just me. But it also comes down to, like you keep pointing out, it is true that Ion says all sorts of stuff, and Ion always does include something much closer to what I think is more accurate or something. I just sometimes, maybe I'm blaming Ion for what people take away, for the stuff people focus on more than other stuff or something.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I see the world that had a certain amount of slack before, and they managed to rob half the slack out of the world, and they're coming for the rest of it, and I hate it, and it makes me fucking angry and sad, and I see that it's only helping to stoke people into this depopulation agenda idea with the vaccines, or the anyone who gets one of these vaxes is going to be dead within a year. This is like, I mean, spreading that idea, it's like, well, then if they're not all dead in a year, then you're done. You have no credibility anymore. No one's
right.
going to listen to anything you say. So what an effective way to marginalize people is get them to say everyone's going to be dead in a year, and then they're not. Brilliant.
Yeah, and
Brilliant
then everybody
plan.
Is
to me,
stupid.
That's the Mason plan.
And
that's
Fauci
Mason
takes
plan
over.
To me. Like,
that's the one.
Yeah.
Would you say that's the Matrix?
That's the Mason plan to me, is the discrediting all of their critics, not killing everybody.
Right.
You know? I don't know.
Okay, well,
I don't know.
We're doing all things. All things are happening.
Now I'm just pushing my opinions about shit. So.
Yeah, and Ion says we're in the rip and no one can tell what's happening. Ion says we know the outcome, but we don't know how we're going to get there. There's too many post-quadrophenic factors involved. But here's another statement, Carolyn. We did a part where it says the vaccine versus the bacterial/virus, that's what the delta is both, versus the fungi. Then in brackets, pleomorphism and the plandemic. I started talking about using the term plandemic. Do you remember that? Does that remind you of something? What? The vaccine versus the bacteria, virus versus the fungi. Pleomorphism and the plandemic.
Yeah, that's where I talked about the Lyda Matman's work, M-A-T-T-E-M-A-N. She and the Canadian Gaston Naissance, they studied pleomorphism, where they say under certain conditions a virus can change into a bacteria, into a fungus, and back again. And I said, so is that what's happening? Is this mRNA creating, or the spike protein, are they creating the environment for pleomorphism, which means things will just be morphing all over the place and driving people crazy because nothing can be pinned down? And I think they agreed.
Yeah.
So that's what's going on. It's impossible to define.
Yeah, so you wouldn't just say it's a virus, like you're saying, Ion's saying. It's this weird mutating thing.
Right. So you catch it at one stage of its
morphosis.
Yeah, morphosis, right. And you think, oh, that's what it is. Because when they define things by looking at them under a microscope or fixing slides, there's no dynamism to that. So they don't realize the morphing. Quite fascinating, really. Lyda Matman, I think maybe she has an internet presence. I mean, she's long dead. I have her book. So there.
But the morphism is Finnegan's Wake, is the electric thing. You know, every 5 seconds there's a new quark particle or something. That's what we're living in. And the tech body understands that or encourages it. So that means you got to give up, quote, your mind. You got to stop trying to figure it out using science or something else, even using channeling, and recognize the endless changing is so much that, like McLuhan predicted, you can't chart the sea we're in. It's you can't get a model of what's happening. So everybody will come in with their bias, and they're all arguing over biases, and they're missing the general environmental flux. So it's not a virus, it's not a bacteria, it's not an injection, it's electric circuitry, it's your television, it's your computer, and it's your neighbor and your child. They're all in the mix. So who can deal with that? No profession can operate with that. Can't make law out of it. You can't establish a grievance and then run with that and go to court about it. So that's where we're stuck. And that's why Ion says you've got to ascend, which means you got to recognize this pattern and figure out how to not be sucked in by it. Which he told Carolyn, who was going to go to a protest, don't go to the protest. See, that's where you get in trouble. If you get in a crowd, you'll get hurt in some form.
Yeah.
Somebody will start shooting.
What? Poke your head up. It's, yeah.
Poke your head up in a crowd.
Yeah.
And, you know, that can be the old social warriors of the old fashioned, that's a cowardice. You're not getting involved with City Hall. You're not trying to acting locally. And they'll run with that meme, but they don't know what they're up against, and they will exhaust themselves. They won't survive trying to implement order. That's why, you know, these people got to get their guns ready to go over to Civil War. That's another mistake.
Yeah, that will. That's going to be scary.
Right. So I see it getting worse and worse, as Ian says. She's going to get worse. And then, luckily, Carolyn made the spray that will stop the Delta virus, but give some release for a minute. Did you know Sidney Powell pointed that out, Brian?
Yeah, I saw what you had said about that she referred to some sprays.
That's because she has inner insider access to us, so she knows about it. It's sort of odd that, you know, she doesn't seem to care about her credibility, and he just says, the government ain't even fucking doing this. They're not going to enhance this, and we don't have it yet. Not here till next week, and she's promoting it. Now, she may not know we don't have it yet.
Yeah.
She just knows Carolyn can do it because she's on our products. So
we just got it.
Today?
So it'll be going out Thursday or Friday. Cool, eh?
Yeah. The solution. The end, the war to end all wars.
Yeah, and I just wanted to put it together because I didn't like the alcohol that they force everyone to put all over themselves. So I just put it together. It's Pico Silver, Pico Zinc, Remag. And then Ion said, oh, why don't you put in some... I put in lemon verbena, and I said, oh, put in some hibiscus. So trying to find hibiscus took about 4 months.
Oh,
so
wow.
We can blame Ion for holding it up for 4 months.
Yeah.
But that's probably
that hibiscus had better be essential.
It's the key.
It's
probably
the secret ionic non-physical ingredient that Ion sticks in all our products. It's the secret.
Yeah.
So it's not what counts. It's the Pico Zinc in that, but it's what is that called? Synthesis.
Hibiscus.
No, the Bucky Fuller word. Synergy. The result is more than the ingredients.
Yeah.
You know, and Ion's very good at that, making synergistic effects. So this stuff, Carolyn didn't even. She wasn't intending to stop the Delta virus variant with this thing, but Ion said, "Oh, by the way, it's going to stop it."
Awesome.
And you can't make the claims anything about it. And so I might have asked Ion. It would be logical I asked. I think I did. Well, how do people find out? We don't care. Those that find it will have it. And that's it. They'll be lucky. Or you didn't even say that. They'll have it. We're not. It's, you can't save everybody, Bob, you know. And the lucky ones will find it. And with Sydney and them, if they start to use it and notice it, then it'll spread fast. Because Ion says that Carolyn will be noticed about this. This one will give her some kind of recognition.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yes.
I'd like to see that start to happen more.
Yeah.
Right. So now you're supposed to spray it on yourself, but do you spray it on things that you touch too, or just the body?
Carolyn says yes. Yeah. You spray it everywhere. Things you touch. Spray it on your neighbor.
Yeah.
On their hand. Oh, your hands are a little dirty there. Let me just spray it. Clean off your hands a bit there.
Right.
You'll lower the value of your house if you walk around with dirty hands.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, they all think in terms of mortgage values. You can't fuck up your property level.
Yeah.
So that's pretty interesting that that's happening. Again, it's a slack method. We didn't fucking even, we stumbled into backwards accidentally once again.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah.
The greatest, the longest running, funniest comedy radio show in history.
Yeah, the longest accident. The longest opera, the longest,
the longest
jazz session. It's all media.
It's amazing.
Wow.
that you have people waking up in the middle of the night to listen to you. I mean, that is almost unheard of. I mean, your reach is amazing around the world. And who would wake up in the middle of the night just to listen to a radio program? No, you know, you have something special.
Yeah, we have an extra ingredient. We got Ion. I mean, we couldn't do this
too.
Without Ion.
No, people are
listening. Okay, yeah,
okay,
I'll take some of the credit. Yeah, put me in there. Executive producer. But I do go that far when people start saying, Carol's the greatest blog. Like, wait a minute, I'm the one who fucking invented Ion. So I'll say that occasionally.
But Carolyn, no, you can't beat. Well, I was going to say you can't beat Carolyn, but no, you're equal in different ways.
Oh yeah, perfect. Well, did you catch what Garrett and Giovanna said? I asked out of the blue in the private session last week. Said, what did Garrett and Giovanna? Giovanna was a Halifax poet, a great friend of Garrett's that we met, and she was a very great person. And she died recently, but she was almost a lover of Garrett. And so I asked, okay, they're watching this. What do they think? Because they knew us way back, the late 60s, early 70s. And Ayn does this really amazing rap. He says, they think that is, they're thrilled because you are showing people this is how you live. You show how to live. And he goes on about that.
Yeah.
Which was a pretty amazing statement. You never expected Ayn to say that, but it's accurate. And Garrett used to kind of say that to me. He used to admire our relationship and compliment it. So it's even based on a bit of reality, I know. Oh, Giovanna definitely said that. Giovanna was there with Harold Midjuck to announce that we were the new Adam and Eve. So he's actually, what Ion said is consistent with what they had said back then in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So, you know, Stan can't do that with Princess Wee Wee.
Right.
But they're, you know, if, what is it to get, the subgenius has been a constant roasting of me and Carolyn. It's just an ongoing roast, right?
Yeah.
Which you're allowed to have.
Right.
You're allowed to put up with a roast. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's technically an honor, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you get to the point where you're worthy of being roasted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the guy in charge, here's the personal angle, the guy in charge of roasting in New York was my neighbor Pussy, the mafia guy who was in the first year of Sopranos and killed at the end because he was an FBI informant. He ran the fucking roast. He was on the committee of it.
Wow. That's cool. I like that.
Yeah. And he was my next door neighbor. He was preparing, living near the greatest roast that was already in progress right next door to him, but he didn't realize it.
Yeah. No, well, it's like, I mean, yeah, that's the thing, like the eternal, the never-ending roast of Bob and Carolyn or whatever.
Yes.
You know, it's making the meme go around. It's creating the content. Like, it's part of the, it's one of the reliable old saws that you can go to
you want a sense of reality.
Squeeze out some fake cheese for the people to eat that day. Like, you can just go to that old
trusty saw. That old saw.
Yes, it's more trusty than most of those saws.
Right now, what the Church of Genius was, a lot of people like Brian who wanted to be writers or artists and painters, and they made very creative fucking tirades. Right, they're incredible. They're tirades. These people. They were smart, creative people. Yeah, it was like very creative. And there were just anybody would show up. And then they started tirading against each other. And that got real crazy.
Yeah.
So,
what do they have as outlets now? If they
well,
can't
this is,
write,
this is, starts in 95.
Yeah.
Somebody told Stang there was something called the internet, so he went on there, and then he opened it up, and then all this crazy people started, friends of his and others started typing, and I was following it. So my form of satire was to come in and say, well, there are certain laws here. There are certain patterns we can rely on. We don't have to be chaotic assholes or quadriphenic. We just need to know the basics so we understand how we're doing Finnegan's Wake. And they would not have it. They were too busy expressing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. As artists, they have to express themselves, right? That's their neurosis. An artist has to paint and draw and doodle. Or pick on their guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Can't stop them. They like play with matter.
Yes. Well, you're an artist in that way, too.
I'm a new kind of artist. I'm a complex completion of everything.
Yeah, right.
And can prove it. And that's why I got picked by the... I won the lottery. No, I got picked as best student of the year. Whatever they do in universities.
You're the
most
valedictorian.
Likely to succeed. So the alien says, yeah, if we go with Bob, I think we got a good chance of pulling this off, whatever we're trying to do.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's what attracted me to you in the first place. You know, that it was like, well, if aliens were to show up and we're going to talk to someone, they would be interested to talk to this guy, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So is there anybody else got anything to say to Brian? You know, you guys should have something to say. It doesn't have to be a question, but Brian has performed well tonight. He's explained himself very well. You should be interested.
I sure hope so.
Yeah, that was fun.
I didn't expect to...
It never happens. The good stuff never is when you expect something.
Yeah.
It's always a surprise.
Yeah.
So,
who wants to say something? There's a whole bunch of people on here.
Hey, Brian, how did you start playing the flute?
My parents enrolled me in that ORF recorder thing when I was really young, you know, like 5 or whatever. It's like this getting kids introduced in music, and then when I'd done that for a couple of years, it was like they offered, you know, like, if you want to learn an instrument, we'll buy you the instrument. What instrument do you want to learn if you want to learn an instrument? So I was like 7 or 8 or something, and I had recently seen someone playing the flute in some band. And I don't know why that spoke to me, but I said the flute. And I guess I was 7 when I started playing the flute, 8 at the latest. So it was definitely young, and I still have that same flute, and I have a newer one as well, but I only just got that very recently. I played the same one for a long time. So I got into that really young, and I don't really know. It really wasn't a thought out decision. It was just for some reason seeing someone play it stuck with me, and
then the parents said, "Here, take this, learn to play it." They ordered you to learn it.
Yeah. I had to, you know, be diligent about my lessons and stuff.
Yeah.
Actually, that reminds me that there was a funny baseball connection to the flute at one point, of like one of these funny incidents in my life where I was like supposed to be practicing. And then I got, you know, bored and decided instead that I was going to practice. I was going to use the flute to practice my Reggie Jackson impression, because he had like a particularly cool kind of swing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like practicing my Reggie Jackson swing, but I wasn't, you know, I didn't know enough about physics at the time that if I swing the flute very rapidly, that the headpiece will just fly out. And it flew out the window and broke the window. And, you know, terrible. It cost money to fix the window. It cost money to fix the flute. It was a terrible thing caused by my stupid baseball obsession. That's just a
How
funny anecdote that comes to mind. Oh, like 9 or something. 10.
Tried to have
10,
some slack.
Girls, I don't know.
Tried to have some slack, and look what happened.
Yeah, I was taking a break from practicing to practice my baseball swing instead, and it's a disaster. But yeah, the flute is fun. I like the flute. It's a beautiful. I was thinking about it in terms of McLuhan, in like, you know, the every technology is an extension of some part of the body. That most of the other wind instruments have a reed, like saxophone or clarinet and oboe, those ones, they have a reed. And the reed is like an extension of the vocal cords, right?
Yeah.
But the flute does not extend the vocal cords. The flute extends just the cheeks. It's just whistling. It's just a very refined form of whistling.
Right.
Which is, I like that about the flute, that it doesn't, you know, it's kind of among the winds, it's unique that way, and not having a reed, and it's not about, yeah, it doesn't engage the voice box, as it were, like all the reed instruments do. But, yeah, I've been playing the flute in the band, and the band, you know, it sucks because I love playing, I've had lots of fun playing with this various bands, but, you know, this is the other COVID thing, is like, fucking live bands are last in line to come back. Very last.
Yeah.
Very end of the line, right? So
yeah.
My band has not played in a year and a half. It sucks. We have a gig scheduled in October, and I'm like totally not confident that it's going to happen.
Right.
Like, it's either probably going to get canceled, or by the time it happens, this like, quote, punk venue will be, you know, on the vanguard of virtue signaling that they only allow vaccinated people in their fucking venue and I won't be allowed to play or something. So it's like I'm not even counting on being able to play a show with them that's indoors anytime soon.
Right.
So, you know, it sucks. But musically, what I've been playing more, I play the saw as well, the singing saw, which is even more unusual as far as instruments go. And it's really slackful because it doesn't, playing the saw is beautiful because I completely ignore all the, it's totally non-visual. There's no, like, I'm completely indifferent to, like, what key things are in or, like, what letter note are you playing? I don't have any fucking idea. It doesn't matter. You don't have to think about that at all because it's just a continuum of a sliding scale of hand-ear coordination that doesn't involve any visual segmenting of notes. It doesn't involve any visual coding of this note codes to this fingering and I do that. Like, no, none of that at all. It's all totally non-visual and just fun. I go out and busk. I play on the sidewalk. It's nice that the weather's warm. So
I do that. Saw, like,
the flute.
Are you talking about a saw, like a construction saw? You know, like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Wood cutting saw.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you play it with a bow.
Oh,
it's fun.
Okay. Well, yeah. Some people in the. In the mountains used to do that, and the washboard and all that. Is
definitely.
That...
Yeah,
yeah,
I really, one day it's kind of like on my bucket list, like I want to play with a real, you know, fucking Appalachian porch band style, you know, saw, jug bass, washboard. Like I do want to play with a band like that someday. That's so cool. Like the Household Items band. I love it, you know. So... Yeah, I practice the saw a lot because it's an income supplement as well on busking. But yeah, it's fun. The flute, I love. Magic flute, it's good. I haven't played it much in the last year and a half, unfortunately. But yeah, I got into it when I was really young, like 7.
That's something that would be neat, like in a coffee shop or something, you know. Having somebody just, you know, listen to that, you know. But I don't think they have coffee shops open anymore, do they? Or maybe.
Not where I live. As long as it's warm enough to sit on the patio, sure. But,
yeah.
Hey, Brian, what was an extension of the vocal cords?
The reed in clarinets and saxophones and oboes,
right?
All the other woodwinds other than the flute.
And the flute is an extension of the whistle. Did you say
of the cheeks. It's just a
cheeks.
Big cheek.
Oh yeah.
It's like a big complicated tubular cheek extension.
Right. Right.
That you set up there. Or, you know, it's like blowing on a bottle or whatever. But in terms of extending, yeah, it's just like, you know, you can go on the top of a bottle.
Yeah.
It's just the same thing that you can have a lot of control over the shape and size of the bottle. But in terms of the, like, extensions of parts of the body, the flute is an extension of the cheek.
Yeah.
That's what I say.
All right. So that's Dimitri. Do you have another question, Dimitri, or a statement?
Well, I mean, I think in rock and roll, the guy that plays the flute a lot is the bassist of Led Zeppelin, and then there's that crazy Hocus Pocus band.
You mean Jethro Tull, or am I thinking
I haven't
else?
Heard them. Hocus Pocus?
Oh, that guy is crazy. The singer of Jethro Tull plays the flute like a maniac. It's that's a good band. I like Jethro Tull. I didn't know so much about the Led Zeppelin flute thing. I didn't know they had a flute. I'm not so much into the classic rock. I'm ignorant. I'm kind of shamefully ignorant of a lot of that stuff. I didn't know that there's a flute. There's really is the guy from Led Zeppelin played the flute.
The bassist, I think. Yeah, I think he's playing.
Wow,
it
cool.
On the intro of. You could probably see it in the live version of Stairway to Heaven.
Cool. Yeah, I got to check that out.
I mean, I'm not sure. I think he's either playing. He's either playing keyboards or
samples.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, cool. Flutes and flute samples are kind of really popular in the like hip hop world these days. Strangely,
yeah,
I don't know why they like to use flute samples.
Well, because it's trebled. It's probably because its range is like the treble, and so human voice is the mids, so it mixes perfectly.
Right. Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
But by not being in that space, so there's less conflict.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And then you also played so hold on. So what kind of band do you guys have? You guys just play punk rock, or is it ska? What is it? I mean, that's kind of weird to play a flute in the. In a funk band.
Yeah, totally. It's, how to describe the sound? I don't know. It's just basically a sort of kind of an open-minded band. I mean, I guess I basically, like, was invited to join the band just by being, like, friends with the band leader guy. And,
yeah.
Like, a flute doesn't hurt or something, you know? Like, it's like, sure, add another thing to the register. And it would be a little more unusual and creative. And, you know, the main riffs will sound more interesting when it's not just a guitar playing them and not just a guitar and a saxophone playing them, but a guitar and a saxophone and a flute at the same time playing them. Like, this will be really interesting. But, we had a bit of a... In 2020, the kind of band leader guy and the people who were more the core of the band before I joined, they wrote this great song, a long song, partially borrowing some lyrics from Alex Jones from the Cremation of Care thing, called Emotional Support Vulture. Was the name of the song, but it's like this long song that has a sort of a Zappa-ish doo-wop section in the middle that benefited from meandering saxophone and flute embellishments on top of it, on top of a basic doo-wop framework. So, yeah, I mean, it's a little stranger to imagine how the flute goes with the sort of just like punk rock-ish thing, but this emotional support vulture song maybe is a little more conventionally suited to the flute, at least in the slowed down middle section with the doo-wop. The doo-wop, man, that's a funny song. But yeah, we're going to be getting together late soon to try to get some rehearsals in. You know, we're all super rusty and haven't played anything in a long time. We're going to see how good we're going to see what we can do. But yeah, I mean, for the most part, I was not adding anything too unusual or singular to the band, but just like reinforcing the riffs that were already there for the most part. Although there was, we had this one song called Sex Tickets. That's about like, it's this sort of just dystopian vignette about like, oh, in the future, you won't be able, you'll have to, you know, you won't be able to, you'll need a ticket to have sex or something. You gotta, you know, two people can't just decide to have sex. You have to like get a government approved ticket or something. And then, so then I, in the world of this like little story, after like chorus number two, we go to this breakdown where the front man says that like, okay, and here's what happens when you don't have any sex tickets. You'll be just like this guy, pointing at me, the flautist. And I like act surprised and shocked that he's singling me out. And he's like, yeah, if you don't have any sex tickets, then you're just a lonely man who can only use his hands. And then I do a solo where I try to musically mime jerking off. Basically, by just like going like do 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 do, where it's like the getting slowly, gradually getting higher in pitch and faster in pace of this kind of up and down thing, and then eventually I'm like do 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 do, and I collapse onto the stage in exhaustion. So that's how this fits into the punk band as well, as this jerking off thing. So.
Wow! So that must have been a real hamper not to get to do it.
Yeah, it was fun. I think we should have at least one good recording of that, or a video recording of that from a live show. Maybe I'll try to find one. Sex tickets.
You're saying you may have one recording of that song? Is that what you just said?
I'm sure. Well, that song was totally a staple of our shows. So I feel like I'm just thinking, oh, surely I could share an example of me doing that jerk off solo thing in a live show. I'll see if there's a good video of it, not just an audio, but I'm not sure.
Right.
Yeah, it was fun.
And then you said you also busk with the singing saw. Are you able to do like real pieces with it, or is it just an improv?
Yeah, well, I mean, I just play melodies that you know, various whatever tunes I can pull off on the saw. I just play them, hopefully recognizable ones, kind of the most. Maybe the most like something like Somewhere Over the Rainbow was like the first kind of hit or something that like really goes, like it really works well on the saw to have those big intervals. And of course everybody knows that song. So that's a good example. I played like Hey Jude was one I've played a lot, but, I there's a ton of songs that I'm familiar with playing now, but this is what I'm saying about the saw being totally non-visual and indifferent to what key things are in. The wonderful perk of that is that as long as I know what the tune sounds like in my head, I can usually play it no problem, even if I've never played it before. So sometimes I can take requests that way, like, because it's all just hand ear coordination or whatever. I don't need to know what key it's in. I don't need to know what note I'm starting on. I just, as long as every note after the first note I play has like the proper interval related to the other ones, then it sounds right. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, sometimes I've had people, I'm talking to people and then I'm like, oh, any requests? And they're like, oh yeah, what about this like silly commercial jingle? And then I just, oh yeah, that's a good one. And I just play it immediately, even though I've never played it before. It's great. You don't need to know how the song is written in any way. As long as you know how it sounds, you can just bust it out on the saw, because you don't need to know anything. You don't need to know anything about the song other than how it sounds. It's really fun that way.
Have you played Godfather on it?
But yeah. Yes. You know what? Thank you. Thank you so much, because that is something I used to play all the fucking time, and I haven't played that in like 2 years or something, because I just didn't remember that was in my repertoire. That one sounds so nice on the solo. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Fucking Godfather. How did I forget that for so long? Right on. Yeah, man, the Godfather. I love that one.
Yeah.
Thank you. Oh, yeah, that's a good one. No, lately I was playing the Hawaii 5-0 theme. That's fun.
Isn't that one kind of faster?
Yeah,
oh, okay.
It's hard. It gets awkward if you're playing like a bouncy rhythm that ever like stays on the same note for a few times. That can be kind of difficult, but I don't know. That Hawaii 5-0 theme goes okay. Or Beautiful Dreamer by Bing Crosby was something I just added to my repertoire lately. A nice melody. Just any nice melody that people recognize, I'm eager to play.
Nothing by Zappa.
I want to get into doing more complicated. I would. I never have. I mean, I'm usually motivated. I'm pretty motivated to try to like fish money out of people's pockets. So I usually try to stick to stuff that I think people recognize. And in that sense, I don't put a whole lot of stock in people recognizing Frank Zappa tunes. So I've never really thought about that too much. But there's got to be at least one or two. Yeah, I should play at least the like Peaches and Regalia. I should try that sometime, at the very least. Yeah.
Well, when it comes to like really
YouTube channel for some soft stuff, but I don't put a lot of work into it.
I think the most complicated pieces you could pull off is Flight of the Bumblebee, and
Yep. Yeah. That would be the ultimate difficulty, because the thing is, it's way easier to do a big interval than those really small ones, like a lot of really do, where I'm like moving, where if I have to barely move the saw and then stop it again at the right note, that's only one semitone away, that's going to be really difficult. It's a lot easier to go like, but yeah, I'm not good enough for that yet. I should probably start trying to learn that. Yes, I know. The Imperial March is one of my big, that's one of my big, like moneymakers. That's when I'm like, I'll see people approaching where I'm like, the Imperial March, Vader's theme will turn their heads. Yeah. That one often turns that, because it's got the octave later. Then you go, bow, 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 bow. That part, yeah. That's fun. Fun to play the Vader's theme for sure. I wonder, well, I haven't recorded that one. I should probably try to throw the Imperial March up on the YouTube channel. Have an example of it there.
So you've been busking, huh?
Yeah. Yep. Yep. In Toronto, it's usually either either chilly or too hot. There's kind of like not that much Goldilocks zone of weather to sit out on the sidewalk and kind of work hard at whatever, like, you know, a day like today or something when it was 30 degrees, like, fuck, I don't want to go sit on the sidewalk and play music, you know. But and of course I don't want to do it when it's really cold in the winter either. But yeah, so there's kind of limited windows when that's feasible. But yeah, I do love the busking. I had a really good time this past Saturday busking. It was pretty good weather. This Saturday seems like it's going to be pretty moderate weather, so should have another good day. But yeah, this is one of the other things that fucking pisses me off about the COVID thing is that, you know, I lost my other job, but I also couldn't fucking bus because no one was out on the sidewalk for so long. And then just as it seemed like, okay, they're finally going to let people back into restaurants and bars and there's finally going to be decent foot traffic on certain sidewalks again, they don't ever want to get back to normal ever again, and they're going to try their hardest not to. So they did whatever they needed to do to convince people that, like, oh, no, we can't yet. Soon, if you get the vax, then it'll, we'll move the goalpost again. Soon, you'll be open. Anyway, so it's like, it's still never gotten to the point where, you know, there's like a nice intersection that I like to busk at that used to be on, you know, like a Saturday night, it would be worth sitting there until 3 a.m. playing. There are enough people.
Wow.
But now it's like even on a Saturday, by the time it gets to be like 9:30 or 10, it's just like crowds are petering out. Like, it's only the dinner restaurant crowds, right? It's like there's no bands playing. There's no dance clubs. People aren't really like packing the bars to just drink late. There are people out eating dinner, and then once the dinner crowd's gone, there isn't enough of a crowd on the street to keep busking. It's just really fucking sad. I used to be able to, if I hustled pretty good and like stayed out for a number of hours and stuff, I used to be able to make a pretty good coin doing the busking. But it's just fucking sad now that it's like Saturday is really the only day that is any good, and it's severely limited compared to what it used to be. Sucks, man.
Yeah. Although I did see in Britain, there's these guys, they just get some amplifiers and they get together. One guy has a keyboard, the other guy has some, like, drum machine. And, you know, like a lot of kids, they just want to be out and dancing. So these guys make house music for them out on the pier.
And they cancel Bruce tour, what's his name? Bruce Springdale.
Springsteen.
Yeah, they canceled his tour after Bruce's pharma squabble. He said he's taking CBD and it was really good for him. I think that's what, I haven't read the article completely, but I think the drug companies objected to him saying that.
Oh, man.
He's marketing it, I think.
Yeah.
He says, when I started this whole thing back in 2019, it really was just a part-time passion project and a way for me to give back. After being given so much, I figured there was no better time to make Prime Nature CBD available to everyone, as it can help thousands of people experience life pain-free and live much happier lives. And it's been flying off the shelves. Well, why doesn't he give it away for free?
Yeah.
So next person wants to have Brian explain his reality.
Yeah, thanks, Brian, for all your answers. That was fun.
What'd you say?
I thanked Brian. It was a good interaction.
Right. Okay, so we got here SIP. Who's this, Nick? Is that you, Nick? Muted, unmuted. Who's that? And then we've got a blocked. Somebody's phoning me. Who the hell would that be? Oh, it's Brian. Let me see.